will be Comedic Interludes by Alan Davies, Sarah Pascoe, John Bishop, Rialina, Ed Byrne and Pam Ayres.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
When does it start, Robin?
Starts this morning at 11.
Good morning. Welcome to the programme. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of November. Good to be with you. Good to have your company. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning: 8 pension mega funds are to be created by the government to try to take advantage of investments that have higher growth potential. And BBC News has learned of a row at the heart of government about the changes to inheritance tax for farms.
Also to be discussed in today's programme.
You know, looking back now, my grandpa died from prostate cancer. My dad has had it, has been treated for it. Why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment? To me, it seems a no-brainer.
After Olympic cycling champion Sir Chris Hoy made that plea for earlier screening for prostate cancer after revealing his terminal diagnosis, another man who has suffered with the same disease joins that call. We'll be speaking to the founder of Soho House, Nick Jones, about his own experiences as a charity also calls for national screening. And Donald Trump's choice of Florida politician Matt Gaetz for Attorney General has shocked some in Washington. We'll hear from a Trump ally on why he thinks it's a good pick.
Matt Gaetz has the personality to not be intimidated by the bureaucracy that's been around there forever and, quite frankly, has not treated President Trump fairly.
All that and more to come. But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is to set out what she's calling the biggest pension reform in decades, involving the merger of dozens of schemes into a handful of pension megafunds. The Treasury says the new funds will take advantage of their size to invest in assets with higher growth potential, helping to increase returns for pensioners and boost the economy. But some experts have warned that the success of the plan will depend heavily on the availability of new infrastructure projects to invest in. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
A fortnight on from a big tax and spend budget, the Chancellor now wants to talk about big reforms needed to grow the economy. She'll announce new legislation to create pensions megafunds, modelled on the Canadian and Australian systems, which she said were the best in the world because they have the scale to invest globally. Just this week, a Canadian public pension fund, in effect, bought 3 British airports to add to large chunks of UK infrastructure which Canadian funds already have stakes in, from water companies to ports, shopping centres and science parks. The local government pension scheme currently has £360 billion in assets, 6.5 million members and is split across 86 different funds. It will be consolidated into 8 mega funds to promote domestic investments in infrastructure and high-tech startups that often outgrow the UK.
A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the tougher rules announced in the budget, but its appeal has been rejected by the Treasury. More from Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt.
From April 2026, farms worth more than £1 million will face an effective rate of 20%. Farmers have warned that this will make it more difficult for families to pass estates down the generations. The Rural Affairs Department has suggested a softening which could exempt some older people, possibly those over 80. The April 2026 start for the policy means they may not have time to make use of existing rules to skip inheritance tax by passing on an asset 7 years before death. Treasury sources have told BBC Newsnight there'll be no change in the budget policy.
A group representing about half of the UK's independent pharmacies has warned that members could reduce opening hours from January after they voted in favour of industrial action for the first time. The National Pharmacy Association says owners are overwhelmingly in favour of limiting services unless the government increases funding. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The National Pharmacy Association says almost all those who voted were in favour of cutting opening times to 40 hours a week, withdrawing free home deliveries of medicines and pulling out of some services such as addiction support. The NPA, which is not a trade union, argues that members in England have seen their government funding cut by 40% in the last decade, even though they're dispensing record levels of prescriptions and providing more clinical services for the NHS. Their counterparts in Wales and Northern Ireland have also voted in favour of action. The Department of Health covering England said community pharmacy had a vital role to play, but the system had been neglected for too long.
The Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police has told the BBC the force is on the verge of eye-watering cuts to its services because of a lack of funding. Sir Mark Rowley has warned finances at Scotland Yard are in a precarious position and that options to balance the books, such as selling police stations, have run out. The Treasury promised at the budget that the core government grant for police forces would increase, but didn't say by how much. Sir Mark said the Met should be treated differently.
I am deeply concerned about the effect on policing London. This is in the context of policing a global city has an extraordinary set of challenges. It's a financial capital. It's got the most diverse, globally connected population. It's a technology capital. And on top of that, of course, you bring protest, politicians, other challenges. If you compare what we spend on policing in London to what gets spent in New York and Sydney, they're spending about 50% more per capita.
You can hear the full interview with Sir Mark Rowley on Political Thinking with Nick Robinson on BBC Sounds. Ministers have appointed a panel of experts to take part in an independent review of prison sentences, chaired by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawke, aimed at tackling overcrowding and reducing reoffending. They include the former Chief Executive of the Crown Prosecution Service, Sir Peter Lewis, and Andrea Simon, who's Executive Director of the End Violence Against Women Coalition. People are being invited to submit their ideas for reform over the next 8 weeks before the review presents its findings to the government next year. Many schools in the Spanish province of Malaga will remain shut today after the region was hit by its heaviest rains in 35 years. Rivers have burst their banks, forcing thousands of people from their homes. But there's been no repeat of the flooding in Valencia 2 weeks ago, when more than 220 people died. The British Museum is to receive the highest value gift in UK museum history, with the acquisition of Chinese ceramics worth up to £1 billion. The items being donated include a chicken cup used to serve wine to the Changhua Emperor. Our culture reporter Guy Lambert takes up the story.
Sitting on display in room 95 at the British Museum is a collection of various ceramics, including the blue and white David vases, said to be two of the best-known Chinese porcelains in the world, and other items from Japan, Hong Kong and Europe. Now, 1,700 pieces of the collection are to be donated by the trustees of the Sir Percival David Foundation. The Foundation's chairman, Colin Sheaf, said this gift would continue to be an inspiration and education for future generations of academics and students.
Guy Lambert reporting.
Thanks very much, Jane. It is just gone 7 minutes past six. Let's hear what the wonderful British weather has in store for us. Stav Danaos is at the BBC Weather Centre.
Thanks very much, Johnny and Emma. Good morning to you. High pressure continues to bring settled weather today and tomorrow with light winds, but a lot of cloud around with limited sunshine once again. So it's not going to be as bright as what we've had to start this week. Then into the weekend, we see some big changes. Conditions start to turn more unsettled as low pressure pushes down from the north. That'll bring some outbreaks of rain, particularly in the north of the country, and also increasing strong winds, northwesterly winds. By Sunday, cold air will engage across Scotland, and this will spread southwards to all areas into the start of next week. So next week is looking very different. It's going to be widespread cold weather with a chance of some sleet and snow in places, and nights will be cold and frosty in places too. So a wintry feel to the weather as we head into next week. Back to the here and now, though, temperatures remain around or a little above the seasonal norm, but it will be rather grey and cloudy. Today, in a bit more detail for Scotland, it is a chilly start in some central and eastern spots, such as Braemar, where temperatures have dipped to freezing. So a touch of frost, a bit of mist and fog, where skies are clear, but for most of Scotland, it's cloudy with some drizzle and some low cloud. Northern Ireland and Wales, mostly cloudy, patchy drizzle, misty, murky conditions. We will see a few sunny spells developing across Wales into this afternoon. Otherwise, it's mostly grey and cloudy. And for England, it's a cloudy, damp start with some patchy light rain or drizzle. Cold start, though, where we've had some clear skies for northwest England, particularly Cumbria. So a touch of frost and fog here. Through the afternoon, sunny spells will develop across England, the best of them across northern, central and eastern areas. And temperatures today, 11 to 14 degrees.
Thanks very much, Stavin. At 9 minutes past six, let's have our first look at the morning papers and what's making news on the websites, because pictures of Donald Trump sitting beside Joe Biden in the Oval Office feature on many of the front pages under the headline "Old Friends Reunited at the White House." The Times says the current US leader used the transitional meeting to urge his successor to stand with Ukraine. On its inside pages, The Guardian's US sketch writer calls the discussion between the two men a triumphant who's got the last laugh now return to Washington for Donald Trump.
The Financial Times has spoken to the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, ahead of her announcement on pensions. She tells the paper that £80 billion of investment could be unlocked under her plan to combine schemes into what she describes as mega funds. The Daily Mail warns the changes could turn out to be a damp squib. Its analysis says there's precious little detail about what requirements will be put on schemes to invest in UK assets.
The Mail's front page focuses on council tax. The paper says Downing Street will allow local authorities in England to increase the charge by up to 5% next year, despite a fall in inflation. The article says that could mean an average annual increase of £110 for a Band D property. But a government source says the 5% cap won't necessarily translate into a similar tax rise, as it will be up to individual councils to decide what to charge.
The Eye says Labour's pledge to build 1.5 million homes by the end of the Parliament has been thrown into doubt. It's seen an email by the official leading the plan in which he says the goal is realistically a two parliamentary term approach. Officials say they're committed to the target.
Police in appalling attack on free speech is the headline on the front of the Daily Telegraph. It says there's an intensifying backlash against Essex Police over an investigation into its journalist, Alison Pearson, for allegedly stirring up racial hatred in a social media post. Boris Johnson has joined the billionaire Elon Musk in criticising the force. The Sun's editorial calls the investigation appalling overreach. Essex Police says it investigates matters without fear or favour, no matter who makes the report or to whom the incident concerns.
And the Daily Mirror says the government has pledged to take action against people who carry out cosmetic procedures with little training. The paper highlights an ITV documentary that's revealed inexperienced practitioners are offering potentially deadly cosmetic surgery. It quotes the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, as saying it's absolutely disgusting that Wild West operators are putting people's lives at risk.
And many of the papers today carry tributes to the actor Timothy West following his death at the age of 90. The Daily Express said he touched the nation's hearts during appearances in Great Canal Journeys alongside his wife Prunella Scales, who has dementia. They were beautiful programmes. The Daily Telegraph says the couple's devotion to each other was obvious, while the Daily Mail opts for theatre's most heartfelt romance since Romeo and Juliet.
It is 12 minutes past six.
Spain is struggling with a second wave of flooding in less than 3 weeks. Guy Hedgecoe is the BBC Spain correspondent who can bring us the latest. Guy, what can we say at this stage?
Good morning, Emma. Yes, well, the city and province of Malaga down on the south coast saw the worst of the weather last night and early this morning. Around 4,000 people have been evacuated from their homes in that area. Streets in the city of Malaga were flooded. One hospital was flooded on its ground floor. There were staff bailing water out of it. And so it's the south that's really been hard hit. But we're told that the worst of that weather is expected to lift within a couple of hours. However, it's the eastern region of Valencia, which was so hard hit 2 weeks ago with the loss of more than 200 lives, which is now on red alert today. We're expecting that weather system to hit Valencia once again. So the people there in that region are preparing themselves. One town, the town of Aldaya, has been setting up sandbags around the centre of the town to protect it. And people are preparing themselves for heavy weather in that eastern region.
And the alert system and how it's been used, is it working well, or is there concern about that?
Well, there has been a lot of talk about the alert system and in particular the way it's used, because 2 weeks ago there was a feeling that the local authorities in Valencia were very slow in responding to the weather alerts and issuing their own alert directly to the phones of the people of Valencia, and many people feel that that caused a tremendous amount of damage or may have even led to the loss of many lives. So there's been a lot of talk about that. This time round, with this weather front that's been hitting Spain, the local authorities seem to have been very cautious in that sense. So they've been responding with their own alerts very promptly once they've received the weather alerts from the National Meteorological Office. So it seems as if the authorities are being very careful in that sense. Certainly Valencia this morning, people are really bracing themselves for the worst, and they are taking precautions, for example, moving out of the ground floors of buildings up into higher floors to ensure that they're away from the worst of the flooding.
Thank you for bringing us the latest. Sounds incredibly difficult indeed. Guy Hedgecoe, BBC Spain correspondent there.
It is 14 minutes past six. There have been more nominations for big jobs by Donald Trump overnight, and a sweet prize for him and the Republicans, control of the House of Representatives. That means the president-elect and his party will control both the legislative and executive functions of the government. Let's have a quick word with Rowan Bridge, our North American correspondent in DC. I asked him first about Trump's pick for Attorney General.
Matt Gaetz is a MAGA loyalist. He forced out the former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. He voted against the 2020 election result, tried to overturn it. He's the subject of an ethics investigation over alleged sexual misconduct and illicit drug use, allegations which I should point out he denies, but a very divisive figure within his own party. And he now has to get confirmed through the Senate. So the question is, will he make it through? The Republicans have a three-seat majority, and they're already some rumblings about whether he's a suitable candidate or not. Lisa Murkowski, a senator, Republican senator, has already said she didn't think it was a serious nomination. So there are some chances that he may not get through. But at the same time, this is Donald Trump at the zenith of his power. So will senators want to go against that? We'll have to wait and see.
And overnight as well, a projection that the president-elect and his party will have control of the entire legislature, the House and the Senate, as well as obviously the White House. That must be cheering Republicans and supporters of the president-elect.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they have the trifecta, as you say. They control all of the arms of the legislative process, in effect. That doesn't mean that Donald Trump will have sort of untrammeled power. There are restrictions over what can get through the Senate, so some laws will require a 60-vote majority to get through. The Republicans don't have 60 votes, so they're going to have to do some workarounds with the Democrats around some stuff. You know, their majority in the House is probably going to be a handful of seats. Again, that's a difficult majority to manage, but certainly, you know, Donald Trump has won the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the popular vote. And I think that gives him a mandate to carry out his agenda. And I'm sure he's going to use that to kind of pressurize the legislature to kind of force through his measures, because he is at the height of his powers at the moment.
Rowan Bridge, thank you very much.
17 minutes past six. Let's turn our attention to some of the stories making the business news today. What went wrong at Homebase? Let's start with that. And how many of its stores can be kept open after the retailer fell into administration? Those are the questions its 2,000 staff will be asking this morning. Will Bain has more on that and the rest of the business news. Will, hello, good morning.
Hi, Emma. Morning. Hi, Johnny. Yeah, this is the DIY and garden stores that have had a pretty bumpy time over the past decade, hasn't it, Homebase? Sold multiple times, including for a quid, to its current owner, Hilco, back in 2018. Hilco had, we know, been looking for a buyer for the whole company before yesterday's news that the administrators had been called in. Professor Sarah Montano, Professor of Retail Marketing at Birmingham Business School, is with us. Professor Montano, morning.
Good morning.
So we know that The Range, one of Homebase's rivals, stepping in to scoop up 75 of those stores. That leaves 49 that we don't know about.
Absolutely. And I think it's unfortunate that we're here once again. We're talking about the demise of a brand that's really familiar to many customers across the UK. So whilst we've heard that the range are likely to take 70 stores, which is going to safeguard around 1,600 jobs, there's another 49 stores at risk. And of course, for those employees, it's a really difficult time with that level of uncertainty just before Christmas.
So what's your sense of what's gone wrong here?
So I think the difficulty for Homebase has been that actually they've come into this cost of living and the challenges with inflation actually not in a great position. As you've just said, they were actually sold for £1 in 2018, actually signalling that the business wasn't doing so well. They made about an £84 million loss last year. So again, that's indicating that customers aren't buying from them. And we've seen this with Wilko. What we're seeing is the range come in, they're going to buy those stores and expand their own portfolio. And this really shows how retail does change over time. Homebase has a limited amount of products. You've really got to choose to go to Homebase, whereas their competitors, as the range are going to take over some of their stores, they tend to be on retail parks. They're quite easy to get to. And when you go in these types of stores, you've got a great range of products you can buy for your home. So they're making shopping convenient and easy, which is what people are looking for.
Right. Interesting. So location, the setup of the stores, but also is size an issue here? I'm sure anybody who's been to a Homebase, they're huge compared to some of those competitors you outlined who have gone for kind of these smaller, perhaps closer to where people live stores where you buy it on an app and you go and pick it up later on.
Yeah, and we've got retail parks are doing quite well at the moment. So retail parks, they're really convenient to get to. You've often got free parking. They're flat, so they're always good for accessibility. And they've got a good mix of retailers within this. Home bases, they tend to be not every single Homebase, but a lot of them, they tend to be individual standalone stores. So you've got to make a really conscious decision to go to a Homebase. Also, we know that customers haven't been spending on what we would call the big ticket items, your bathrooms, your kitchens, while people are, you know, concerned with costs at the moment. So that's another added difficulty for Homebase there.
Yeah, and as you said, it's been in some scrapes before as a company. Look ahead for us. What does it look like at the end of this latest round?
I mean, I think it's always difficult to predict where we're going to be in a couple of years' time in retail because things do change so quickly. And we know that there will certainly be some surprises coming over the next couple of years. I think there's a couple of ways that this might play out, that the range will most likely take over the Homebase stores. They'll rebrand them. And what we might see is Homebase products within the range, or potentially what we will see is the Homebase brand just disappear completely. And of those stores that have been taken over, they will become whatever retailer actually takes over those stores. So it might be the complete demise of the brand.
Sarah, thanks so much for your time this morning. Professor Sarah Montano there, a professor of retail marketing at Birmingham Business School. Well, Gervase Williams, head of equities at Premier Miton, is with us this morning as well. Gervase, morning. Quick thought on Homebase.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, really, because we have seen other insolvencies there as well with Wilko's and others. So basically, we've seen new competitors coming on, current companies being outcompeted, and of course, extra costs coming through. We've seen with the budget extra costs coming through. I think that's why it's come at this time.
Let's turn to what I think is going to be the big market story later today. We heard Faisal Islam talking about it in the news bulletins, and he's been speaking to the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, ahead of what she's calling the biggest pension reform in decades at her Mansion House speech later. Pick through what you'll be looking out for, what you think are the most interesting elements.
Well, this is really moving on from the budget speech, really, to putting together the structure which will actually bring more investment for the UK. We need more local companies being supported by local capital. It's obviously, a lot of it's moved overseas. So she'll be looking to bring more opportunities for some of the younger companies, to private companies, to have finance. But ultimately, really, the bigger picture will be the allocation of UK pension schemes at UK insurance companies in the UK. And I think that's going to be a very significant part, along with Emma Reynolds' review, which we'll be reporting at the end of this year.
What about this idea, these so-called mega funds, so consolidating local authority pensions?
Yes, I mean, really, we you know, globalisation has really been all about bigness. As we move to protectionism, smallness will be more important. I'm disappointed, actually, that the pension schemes of the local authorities are being consolidated. They've always been able to invest in big companies, but also small companies. And I think with this consolidation, these mega funds, by implication, they'll invest in mega companies, and many of the smaller companies will be, unfortunately, less significant in them going forward.
Right, so you might see even less risk-taking.
That's right. I mean, I think it's a real mistake, because actually the great advantage of the UK isn't just that we've got some companies which are large global players. Many of these companies generate surplus cash and pay good and growing income. And I think good and growing income is going to be a particularly feature during this period of as we move into a period where we're kind of going protectionism and nationalism and all that kind of thing. And I think the UK is superbly positioned for that. I think the UK small company sector specifically will be one of the best performing parts of the market, in one of the best performing stock markets in the world. So actually, I think it's a mistake to consolidate the local authorities' pension schemes.
And just briefly explain this Pisces idea as well, sort of private companies being able to list for a sort of a short amount of time.
Yes, we really, it's good that the UK has a great stepladder where companies can come up, and your different types of company, EIS and all of the VCT. Pisces is a way of allowing companies to come into that sector where perhaps they're private businesses. They don't want to take a listing. They don't want to take a stock market quotation at this stage. And it's just providing another opportunity for them, along with other methods. I mean, JP Jenkins also lists private companies. So it's not innovative, but it's bringing another choice for companies.
And we're going to be talking more pensions after 7 o'clock here on the programme. Gervais Williams, thanks so much for your time. Gervais is the head of equities at Premier Miton. Now, the car hire firm Europe Car has told us its leisure customers are currently still reluctant to hire an electric vehicle and will remain so until the UK's charging infrastructure is improved. Gary Smith, Europe Car's Managing Director for the UK, Ireland and Nordic countries, told us more about that and the current environment for his business and the 2,000 staff he has here in the UK.
As many businesses, we're in a challenging environment. However, as Europe Car, we have a nice mix of business where we provide mobility solutions across both the corporate sector and leisure customers. The business does have a few headwinds, and particularly resulting from the recent budget announcements. So as an employer of over 2,000 members of staff, the minimum wage and the national insurance changes has hit us quite hard. But actually the larger impact for us was the vehicle excise duty changes. We're looking at registering over 35,000 vehicles this year and similar numbers into next year. And the vehicle excise duty, as you know, has effectively been doubled for the first year of registration. So that has a significant impact on anybody that is registering cars. So the fleet and leasing sector is the largest impacted area in that sense. The impact for just my business alone in the UK is in excess of £5 million a year.
Well, and presumably that is not something that you've, however much you plan for that, that's coming in soon. You're not going to be able to make those plans in time, really, to brace for all of that impact.
Yeah, the challenge that we will have is that becomes effective on the 1st of April. Yeah, really where we are is that we're going to need to look at ways in which we can minimise the impact to us as a business, and that generally will be passing some of that cost on to our customers. But I guess the biggest challenge for us and the elephant in the room is the transition to electric vehicles. That is going to be a challenge for everyone, but particularly in my business, because we've got a lot of uncertainty still around the time when the government plans to move to zero emission vehicles. Is it going to be 2035, or will it be potentially brought forward to 2030? From our businesses and our industry's perspective, the clarification is of the date is important. We don't mind which date it is. We can be reasonably agile and move to the earlier date, but we will need to work on our action plans to make that happen.
And for just explain us, why you wouldn't just go for it regardless, if you see what I mean. Use the closest number. Why wouldn't that make sense commercially?
So at the moment, in our business, we're split between corporate activity and commercial and leisure activity. And the leisure market is really not ready for electric vehicles. So there's a lot of people that will come into the country from one of our airport locations, and they won't be familiar with the road and where they're travelling to, and they certainly won't be familiar with the charging infrastructure. And that really does give us a challenge, because our leisure customers are telling us that they don't want to rent electric vehicles right now. The country isn't quite ready. Unfortunately, if you're in a comfortable ICE vehicle and you have no reason to change, the government's going to have to incentivize people to make that switch. And then the charging infrastructure is just not large enough to be able to cope with the number of vehicles that we will need to have on EV.
Gary Smith, the UK boss of Europcar there, and the government in agreement with him on trying to leverage, as they put it, the transition to reinvigorate the electric vehicle sector through their EV strategy, Johnny.
Thanks, Will. More from you after 7 o'clock, but right now it is 29 minutes past six. Here's Cathy with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. The England men's captain, Harry Kane, has expressed his disappointment that 9 players have withdrawn from the latest international squad, insisting England comes before club. Kane's criticism is ahead of tonight's Nations League game against Greece. The BBC's football correspondent, John Murray, reports.
Lee Carsley's remit as interim head coach was to finish top of this group to win promotion back to the top tier of the Nations League. If England fail to win tonight, that will not be possible, and he'll be handing on a playoff tie in March to Thomas Tuchel for the Germans' first matches in charge. Carsley's lost a third of the players from this squad to injury withdrawals, so the team he selects will have an inexperienced and youthful look about it. Only 4 of the 23 he's left with have actually scored a goal for England, but that does include captain Harry Kane with his 68, who looks as important as ever for his country. Against a Greek team who are enjoying their best time since winning the Euros 20 years ago, they've won their last 5 internationals, including at Wembley last month, will have a raucous sellout crowd behind them, and a draw is enough for promotion for them.
The Republic of Ireland host Finland in Dublin tonight before facing England on Sunday. Last night, Chelsea women beat Celtic 2-1 in the Champions League to remain top of their group. The football referees body, PGMOL, says it's taking new allegations around Premier League official David Coote very seriously. Coote is suspended from his role pending an investigation into a video which emerged earlier this week, in which he appeared to make disparaging remarks about the former Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp. The PGMOL statement yesterday came after the Sun newspaper published pictures it says were taken during this summer's European Championship, alleging they appear to show Coote sniffing a white powder through a rolled-up US banknote. Coote was working at the Euros in his capacity as a match official. Lord Coe is one of 7 confirmed candidates aiming to succeed Thomas Bach as the International Olympic Committee president next March. He's currently president of World Athletics and feels he has the necessary experience for the IOC's top role.
You know, I've competed in Olympic Games, and Olympic Games was impacted by a boycott. I went to a second Olympic Games that was also impacted by a boycott. I've chaired a National Olympic Committee, helped deliver a Games in London where not every country was universally excited about, at that stage, our foreign policy.
Tennis, and the 2-time Wimbledon champion Carlos Alcaraz beat the world number 8 Andrei Rublev at the end of season ATP finals in Turin, despite suffering from a chest condition. And the world number 2 Alexander Zverev claimed his second victory of the week, defeating Norway's Casper Ruud. And in cricket, England's men are 2-0 ahead in their T20 series with West Indies, with the third match taking place in St Lucia later today.
Sounds lovely. Thanks very much. Not that I'd rather be there, because guess what? We've got Cold War drama for you this weekend.
It is Thursday, the 7th of September, 1978. I am walking across Waterloo Bridge in central London, and I am about to be murdered with a poison-tipped umbrella.
Brand new drama starring Simon McBurney and Christopher Eccleston.
You come here and presume to lecture me about the truth.
Inspired by real events, the life and death of Georgi Markov.
It is, not to put too fine a point on it, a warning from history.
Breaking the Rules, The Markov File, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, on Saturday afternoon at 3.
It is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Johnny Diamond. Let's get a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will use her first Mansion House speech later to set out plans for what she says will be the biggest pension reform in decades. 86 separate local government pension funds will be combined into 8 so-called mega funds, a move that will aim to take advantage of their size to invest in assets with higher growth potential. A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. From April 2026, farms worth more than £1 million will face an effective rate of 20%. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the tougher rules announced in the budget. The Treasury has insisted there will be no change in the policy. A group representing about half of the UK's independent pharmacies has warned that members could reduce opening hours in England, Wales and Northern Ireland from January after they voted in favour of industrial action for the first time. The National Pharmacy Association says services such as home deliveries could also be affected unless the government increases funding. The Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police says the force is on the verge of eye-watering cuts to its services because of a lack of funding. Sir Mark Rowley told the Political Thinking podcast that options to balance the books had run out. The Treasury promised in the budget that the core government grant for police forces would increase, but didn't say by how much. A panel of experts has been appointed to carry out a review of prison sentencing in England and Wales in a bid to reduce overcrowding and reoffending. Those on the panel include a retired Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett. People are also being invited to submit their ideas for reform over the next 8 weeks. Parts of the Valencia region in Spain could be hit by up to 5 inches of rain 2 weeks after flash flooding killed more than 200 people. The local authorities are urging people to stack sandbags in anticipation, and people are being urged to work from home. All non-essential activities have been cancelled.
Jane, thank you very much. At 26 minutes to 7, let's pick up on one of those stories in the bulletin, because last month the government asked David Gawke, a former Conservative Justice Secretary, to lead a sentencing review to tackle overcrowding in our prisons and to reduce reoffending. This was after the new Labour government, as it was, controversially let out around 2,800 prisoners early in 2 mass releases, one in September and another in October, in a bid to relieve pressure on the prison system. Well, today that sentencing review kicks off with a call to evidence. Will Vernon's here, our correspondent. Good morning. Who's being invited to submit ideas for reform?
Well, firstly, Emma, I mean, we already knew this independent review had been set up. The government announced it earlier this year, as you said. It's going to examine possible changes to how offenders are sentenced in England and Wales. And most importantly, the question of whether shorter prison sentences of under 6 months are basically worthwhile, right? Should they be replaced by community orders, so punishments that take place outside of prison? That, of course, would relieve the overcrowding in the prisons. Now, today, the government has released more details about this review. They've announced that the panel of experts that are going to work with David Gawke, they include Lord Burnett, he's a former Lord Chief Justice, and the former chief executives of the Crown Prosecution Service and the Prison Service. Now, interestingly, Andrea Simon, who's the executive director of End Violence Against Women, is on the panel too. Now, that appointment may be trying to kind of head off some of the criticism the government has had about the risk to women amongst all of this. Because, as you mentioned, almost 3,000 offenders have been released early. Some groups have said that this puts vulnerable women at risk. At least one offender released early under the scheme went on to sexually assault a woman. Now, the government says that those convicted of domestic abuse or connected crimes are not eligible for early release. But there are still concerns about sentencing and the risk to women more generally. Now, in this announcement today, the government has said the review is launching an 8-week-long call for public evidence. So experts, members of the public, they're invited to share ideas for sentencing reform with them. Now, David Gawke, the chair of the review, he said he welcomed responses that challenge current thinking and are innovative. So get your thinking caps on about that one. Now, as well as listening to the public, the panel will also look at how to use technology and best practice from other countries too. There's an example from the US state of Texas, where the Republican governor there introduced a scheme to free up space in prisons where offenders were sent on courses to be taught report about good behaviour and the roots of crime in exchange for early release. And that freed up cells and reduced crime overall. So the panel will be looking at all of that and coming up with proposals for England and Wales, and they'll be presented next year.
We are going to be hearing from David Gawk just after 8 o'clock this morning, and get your thinking caps on, I think is what we're hearing from Will Vernon there, with potential suggestions for reform, as innovative as they may be. Thank you.
It is 22 minutes to seven. The Chancellor heads to the Mansion House in London this evening to give the traditional big speech to city grandees. Word is she will have an announcement about public pension funds and their investment potential. Important stuff for a government that wants to invest, invest, invest. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Good morning, Henry.
Morning.
What's the story with the speech coming up?
Mega funds. That's the somewhat dramatic term for what is a technical but really quite significant announcement from the government here. What Rachel Reeves will fire the starting gun on is legislation which will probably start next year, which would merge the pension funds managed currently by 86 local government pension scheme authorities, representing 6.5 million pensions, into a far smaller number of mega funds. And the government's view is that by creating those smaller number of much bigger funds, that would allow those funds to invest more in infrastructure and business in the UK. It's based on similar schemes in Australia and Canada, where the size and scale of pension funds means that they can invest in assets which have higher growth potentials. Rachel Reeves says makes no sense at all, in her words, that Canadian and Australian teachers and public sector workers are more likely to be invested in some long-term UK assets because of those pension fund size than Brits are because of our pension funds sizes. And by the way, there's a private sector component to this too. The government also is likely to set a minimum size for defined contribution schemes in the private sector, also designed to encourage smaller funds to consolidate into bigger funds.
Okay, that's brilliant. We'll get the detail on that presumably this evening at the Mansion House speech. There's also rumblings of a row, isn't there, between the Treasury and the Department of Rural Affairs over the introduction of inheritance tax on farms worth more than £1 million.
As a reminder, in the budget, Rachel Reeves announced that from April 2026, so pretty soon, farms worth more than £1 million will face an effective inheritance tax rate of 20%, having previously been exempt. And we've heard, haven't we, farmers warning that this would make it more difficult for families to pass estates down the generations as they have done in the past. Our colleague Nick Watt at BBC Newsnight has been hearing that the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has suggested various ways in which this policy could be softened. So perhaps you would exempt people over the age of 80 who wouldn't be able to find a way to pass down the farm in the coming years. But Treasury sources told BBC Newsnight there'll be no change to the policy. Interestingly, a lot of the focus in Westminster, and you saw it at Prime Minister's questions yesterday, understandably has been on the national insurance rise, which was the big ticket item of the budget. But actually, MP after MP from the Labour Party who I speak to says that's gone down okay among their constituents, even among small and medium-sized businesses in their constituencies. But more and more rural MPs, and because of their success in the general election, Labour have quite a lot of rural MPs now, are warning about the damaging consequences politically, potentially, of this.
Henry, thank you. We will leave it there. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent.
It's 19 minutes to seven. Israel suffered one of the deadliest days of its ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon yesterday. Six of its soldiers were killed in combat near the border, as Israel's new defence minister, Israel Katz, said there would be no easing up in its war against Hezbollah. On the same day, an Israeli strike hit Aramun, a densely packed area south of Beirut that is outside Hezbollah's traditional strongholds, which the Lebanon Health Ministry said killed eight people. Joe Inwood, our BBC correspondent, is in Jerusalem. What is the latest on that ground offensive?
Yeah, so these six soldiers were from the Golani Brigade, and they were taking part in the ongoing operation that's taking place in the south of Lebanon. It seems they were involved in a firefight with four Hezbollah fighters. They tried to go into a house, and all six of them were killed. There was one other person injured. As you say, this is one of the most deadly days, one of the most deadly incidents for Israel. There have been a couple of others where more people have died in a single day. There were 24 killed in January. But this takes the total number of Israeli soldiers killed in Lebanon to 47. It is worth remembering, on the same day that this is very significant for the Israelis, on that same day in Lebanon, 78 people were killed, according to the Lebanese ministry, in various strikes. And the one that you mentioned there is particularly interesting, is Amarun, in which 8 people died, which is outside of the traditional Hezbollah strongholds where a lot of these strikes have been taking place.
Joe Inwood, our correspondent in Jerusalem. Thank you.
It is 17 minutes to 7. In Parliament yesterday, concern about the impact of the hike in employers' national insurance contributions on GPs and on other care providers dominated Prime Minister's question time. But it was the Reform UK leader, Nigel Farage, who seemed to enjoy the session most. Our correspondent Susan Hume was watching.
Preparations in Downing Street for Prime Minister's question time will involve much tactical scrutiny of the list of MPs due to put a question and game planning what they might ask. First on the list this week was Christine Jardine, a Lib Dem, so unlikely to have a particularly friendly question. And indeed, she was worried about the decision to raise employers' national insurance contributions. She said she'd been contacted by lots of her local GPs.
With their genuine fears that the impact of the changes to national insurance employers' contribution will threaten their ability to continue to offer the public the health service at the standard they do at the moment.
Sir Keir Starmer promised there was more money for health, including £600 million for social care, and GPs would get what they needed. But those Downing Street planners must have been relieved to see that next on the list was an enthusiastic new Labour MP, Lloyd Hatton, because it turned out that what he wanted to ask about was Kemi Badenoch and what he called her damaging policies.
This includes voting against critical investment for our NHS, stating that maternity pay is excessive and the minimum wage a burden.
Fortuitously, Mr. Hatton had the question right before the new opposition leader was due to stand up, thus giving Keir Starmer the chance to get his attack in first. He extolled his government's decision so far.
Now, I haven't heard the Leader of the Opposition clarify why she opposes all these things, but now is her chance.
Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch.
Kemi Badenoch stood up with a wry smile.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister can plant as many questions as is like with his backbenchers. But at the end of the day, I'm the one he has to face at the dispatch box.
She reckoned that £600 million would not cover the extra costs of employers' national insurance in the social care sector, and it wasn't the only sector affected.
It is clear that they had not thought through the impact of the budget, and this is the problem with having a copy and paste Chancellor. Did they not realise that care homes... Care homes, GP surgeries, children's nurseries, hospices, and even charities have to pay employers' NI.
So Keir Starmer said the Conservatives had left local authorities in a catastrophic state.
We produced a budget which does not increase tax on working people, nothing in the payslip. Investing in our NHS, investing in our schools so every child can go as far as their talent will take them, investing in the houses of the future. If she's against those things, she should say so.
To the delight of Labour MPs, Kemi Badenoch promised she wasn't against those things, but she turned to a technique much beloved of opposition leaders, the case of the real person.
Let me tell you about Kelly.
Kelly runs after school clubs for 500 children and their families.
In 2024, her national insurance cost was about £10,000. In April, this will rise to £26,000. That is a 150% increase in costs from the budget alone. What is the Prime Minister's message to Kelly and the 500 families her small business supports if it goes under?
I would say this to Kelly. We inherited a very badly damaged economy. We inherited a £22 billion black hole, and we were not prepared to continue with the fiction.
And he said that given the Conservatives' record, he didn't much want her advice on running the economy. Speaking of political advice, the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, is just back from the United States, where he'd been at Donald Trump's victory party.
I'm sure the Prime Minister and the whole House would wish to congratulate Donald Trump on his landslide victory last week.
Mr. Farage grinned wolfishly at the hecklers, but went on to say Iran's Republican Guard was behind a further assassination attempt on Donald Trump. So would the Prime Minister agree to proscribe the organisation?
And in doing so, not just do the right thing, but maybe mend some fences between this government and the incoming presidency of Donald Trump's, given that the whole of his cabinet have been so rude about him over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see the honourable member making a rare appearance back here in Britain. He spent so much time in America recently, I was half expecting to see him on the immigration statistics when we see him.
Nigel Farage put his head back and laughed bigly at that.
Susan Hume reporting. You can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on BBC Sounds.
At 12 minutes to 7, let's think about something else entirely, because every 45 minutes, one man dies of prostate cancer. That's more than 12,000 men every year. But there isn't a national screening programme for the disease in the UK. It has been front of mind recently, after the Olympic legend Sir Chris Hoy, who has revealed his terminal prostate cancer diagnosis, prompted the Health Secretary to say he will review guidance around testing in NHS England. But today, a report will be presented at the House of Commons trying to show the economic benefits of national screening. Oliver Kemp is the Chief Executive of Prostate Cancer Research, which is behind that report. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us what your report is saying.
So basically it's saying that we used to have a moral argument for screening and we now have an economic one as well. By using the latest technology, we could diagnose 4,600 people early, giving them 100% chance of survival at stage one. And that would deliver a net economic benefit of £200 million.
What isn't working then at the moment? So what are you calling for to change once you've made that argument, if it's accepted?
So currently we rely on a system of informed choice. And not everyone's even aware that they have a prostate, never mind aware that they're at higher risk. So if they've got family history, like Sir Chris Hoy had, or if they're black men. So that informed choice system isn't working. Not as many people are turning up at their doctors as they should be. And some people obviously don't get symptoms, like Sir Chris Hoy. Shoulder pain means that the cancer's already spread, which is obviously far more dangerous.
But what are the symptoms?
So not being able to empty your bladder fully, finding that you're having to go to the toilet multiple times, for later stages, it's kind of like back pain and shoulder pain because the cancer spreads to the bone.
And you're calling, therefore, if not for informed choice, what sort of screening programme? How would it work?
So, yeah, we would ask for a similar screening programme to some of the others that are already in existence for other cancers, for breast cancer, for bowel cancer. The targeted approach of getting letters through the door, text messages saying, please go and see, please go and get a PSA test as a first line, then onto an MRI, and then onto a guided biopsy if the results say so.
The first thing to say, especially if there are those men who are squeamish about this or concerned, or perhaps it hasn't even crossed their path, is the PSA test, that stands for, you can tell us what it stands for, but it's also a blood test, isn't it? That's the first thing.
Yeah, so I think lots of people think of digital rectal exams. That doesn't happen. It happens very rarely anymore, and it's not a particularly good way of finding cancer. So a PSA test is just a simple blood test. Send you a sample off, and you get the results a few days later.
And would you be, if there was this screening programme that you would like to be in place, what age or how would it begin in men's lives?
So particularly for the high-risk groups, we'd start it earlier from 45 or 50, running up to 69. If you were to provide, say, across the whole population, we're asking for 50 to 69.
Okay, and that would be how it would work. Although, what is the reason why that hasn't been put in place? Because there are some issues, and we're going to get into this a bit later in the programme, about the accuracy of the PSA test.
Yes, and definitely. No, I think nobody's arguing for just a PSA test and then you're having your prostate taken out. We want multiple different tests in place to funnel that group of people to prevent overdiagnosis, to prevent overtreatment. There are lots of good new tests already coming onto the market to provide other levels in that funnel and gradually reduce the number of overdiagnoses. But I think it's also been an economic argument. You know, can we afford to do this? Obviously, all of the, what we've tried to do in the report is include all of the additional costs of ensuring that men are around for longer, paying their taxes for longer, looking after their grandkids for longer. All of those things have been taken into account.
There are also some studies and you know, sometimes not quantifiable ones, but around that men are not very good sometimes at going to the doctor generally. And that if they live with women, they can naturally live longer lives because they have family and those around them telling them to go to the doctor. How much of a barrier is that side of things?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we certainly find that some men see it as a badge of honour that they haven't gone to the doctor. But we also surveyed men and said, you know, if you did get a letter through the post, would you go? And over 80% of men said that they would.
There you go. Oliver Kemp, we'll go into this in more detail and with someone who was diagnosed with prostate cancer a bit later in the programme. Chief Executive of Prostate Cancer Research there.
It's 7 minutes to seven. Bird brain is generally meant as an insult, but it is those that fling it that are the fools. We've known for a while that birds are, as the animal kingdom goes, really rather clever. What we haven't known until now is how they got so clever, how their brains evolved over tens of millions of years to become what they are today. But the discovery of an 80 million year old fossil in Brazil is opening the door to how that brain change took place. There's a report just been published in the journal Nature. Daniel Field is Professor of Vertebrate Paleontology at the University of Cambridge and senior author of the report. Good morning, Professor Field.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you on. What did you find?
So this is a new species of fossil bird from about 80 million years ago named Navaornis. And what's really remarkable about Navaornis is that its skeleton and particularly its skull are more completely and three-dimensionally preserved than any other bird-like animal of that age, which allows us to learn quite a lot about the biology of this animal.
And you found that its brain is a kind of bridge between the clever birds of today and the not-so-bright birds of the dinosaur era. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So we're very lucky when it comes to the skulls of modern birds, because if we look inside those skulls, the bones that form the skull provide us with a very accurate picture of the external geometry of the brain. And this is a technique that we can apply to fossils too, to understand how the brains of birds evolved. But the problem is that most fossil birds tend to be preserved totally flattened and broken up, which means we can't really get a good picture of what those brains looked like. But with Navaornis, we had this unprecedented opportunity to do that, which shows this fascinating intermediate stage in the evolution of the bird brain between the very expanded brains of modern birds, which support the complex behaviors that we know and love in the present day, and the very archaic, far less intelligent sort of brains that we associate with non-avian dinosaurs.
So you got a perfect skull instead of a sort of flat one. And then how did you get from that to what its brain looked like?
Well, over the last 20 years in the field of paleontology, our ability to use micro CT scanning, basically combining high-powered X-rays with a turntable that spins the fossil around while it's being scanned, allows us to generate these very high-resolution three-dimensional images of fossils that we can actually peer inside of. So this is the technique that allowed us to generate a really nice high-resolution three-dimensional model of the skull of Navaornis and reconstruct in three dimensions what its brain would have looked like.
Wonders never cease. Are you done with the poor little thing, or is there more to be gleaned from this very old bird?
Oh, I think there's quite a lot left to learn about the biology of Navaornis. So we know a lot about what its brain looked like, and we have a sense of approximately how intelligent it would have been relative to living birds. But there's a lot we don't understand yet about its biology, what it ate, what its lifestyle was like. There's more that we have to learn about the habitat that it inhabited. And once those details come to light, I think we'll understand much more clearly what an animal with a brain like that of Navaornis was actually doing in the environment that it lived in 80 million years ago.
Professor Field, we wish you the very best of luck with your investigations, and thank you very much for coming on this morning.
That's 3 minutes to seven. Shall we get the weather forecast? Here's Stav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Emma and Johnny. Good morning to you. High pressure continues to bring settled conditions today and tomorrow. Winds will be light from the north, but we will see quite a bit of cloud both today and tomorrow with limited sunshine once again. As we head into the weekend, conditions start to change. Low pressure across the north of the UK will start to bring stronger northwesterly winds, and that'll push down some colder air and some rain during Sunday. The cold air will move to all areas as we head into next week, and then it'll be pretty cold for most of next week. Widespread chilly weather with chance of some sleet and snow in places. You have to stay tuned to the forecast for that, as some of it could be disruptive. Today, though, it's a pretty quiet start to the day. A lot of cloud around, generally some mist and fog. Where we've had clear skies, though, temperatures have been below freezing. So for Scotland, it's a cold start to central and eastern parts, such as Braemar, where we're down to -3 Celsius now. Touch of mist and fog too. But for most of Scotland, it's cloudy with a little bit of light rain and drizzle. Northern Ireland and Wales, mostly cloudy, patchy drizzle, misty, murky conditions, but fairly mild temperatures in double figures. We'll see a few sunny spells developing into this afternoon. For England, cloudy damp starts and patchy light rain and drizzle for many. However, where skies have been clear across Cumbria and Northumberland, a touch of frost here and also some dense fog patches to watch out for. Sunny spells will develop quite widely this afternoon, best of them northern, central and eastern England. Light winds today for all from the north, temperatures 11 to 14 degrees. So that's around or a little above the seasonal norm. Tonight, it looks like most places will be cloudy. So again, not so cold. A few clear spots for southwest England here. It will turn chilly, and then into tomorrow much the same, a lot of cloud round with limited spells of sunshine. That's your forecast.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett.
Today is the birthday of His Majesty the King.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, it's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of November. The headlines today. Ministers say they will attempt to harness the untapped potential of pensions for infrastructure investment by creating 8 mega funds. The Treasury has rejected proposals to soften new rules around inheritance tax for farmers. We will hear from an organiser of next week's farmers' protest. And independent pharmacies in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have voted in favour of industrial action for the very first time.
Coming up in the next hour, what will Donald Trump do with his clean sweep of America's branches of government? And,
you know, I'm 39 years old. Like, don't think there's another cyclist that is quite as competitive as I'm my age. You know, there's a few, but not as a generalisation. Like, I'm a bit old now. And basically, I've done everything I can do in the sport.
The fast man slowing down. We hear from cycling sprinting superstar Mark Cavendish. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is to set out what she's called the biggest pension reform in decades, involving the merger of dozens of schemes into a handful of pension mega funds. The Treasury says the new funds will take advantage of their size to invest in assets with higher growth potential, helping to increase returns for pensioners and boost the economy. But some experts have warned that the success of the plan will depend heavily on the availability of new infrastructure projects to invest in. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
A fortnight on from a big tax and spend budget, the Chancellor now wants to talk about big reforms needed to grow the economy. She will announce new legislation to create pensions mega funds modelled on systems used overseas.
Australia and Canada probably have the best pension funds anywhere in the world. And the reason they're so successful is that they have a small number of mega funds that have the scale to be able to invest not just domestically, but indeed around the world.
Just this week, a Canadian public pension fund in effect bought three British airports to add to large chunks of UK infrastructure which Canadian funds already have stakes in, from water companies to ports, shopping centres and science parks. The local government pension scheme currently has £360 billion in assets, 6.5 million members, and is split across 86 different funds. It will be consolidated into 8 mega funds to promote domestic investments in infrastructure and high-tech startups that often outgrow the UK. Rachel Reeves will have to convince the business community about her growth plans after a backlash from retailers in the hospitality industry over the forthcoming rise to employer national insurance.
A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the tougher rules announced in the budget, but its appeal has been rejected by the Treasury. More from Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt.
It's a good old Whitehall clash. In one corner stands the department representing the interests of farmers. It believes it was not properly consulted on the budget, which ended an inheritance tax exemption for farms. From April 2026, farms worth more than £1 million will face an effective rate of 20%. Farmers have warned that this will make it more difficult for families to pass estates down the generations. The Rural Affairs Department has suggested a softening which could exempt some older people, possibly those over 80. The April 2026 start for the policy means they may not have time to make use of existing rules to skip inheritance tax by passing on an asset 7 years before death. But Treasury sources have told BBC Newsnight there'll be no change in the budget policy.
A group representing about half of the UK's independent pharmacies has warned that members could reduce opening hours from January after they voted in favour of industrial action for the first time. The National Pharmacy Association says owners in England, Wales and Northern Ireland are also overwhelmingly in favour of limiting services such as home deliveries unless the government increases funding. The Department of Health covering England said the system had been neglected for too long. Ashley Cohen has owned a pharmacy in Leeds for 18 years and says it's become more difficult to make ends meet.
I've got responsibilities to the lease, to my staff, to my community. I'm here as a healthcare professional. I should be spending my time and energy in trying to prevent illness and do everything that the government wants us to do, to be agile in terms of treating illness and making people better. But my time is being spent on, have we got enough money to pay the bills in 30, 60, 90 days' time?
The Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police has warned that the force is heading for eye-watering cuts to its services because of a lack of funding. Sir Mark Rowley has told the BBC he will have to make very difficult choices. Our political correspondent Helen Catt reports.
Sir Mark told the Political Thinking with Nick Robinson podcast that the Met had been put in a precarious position as a result of the cumulative effect of decisions taken over the last decade. He said that some of the measures that successive commissioners and mayors had used to balance the books, such as selling police stations and using reserves, had run out, and that, combined with a difficult public sector outlook, would lead to a dramatic change in budgets that couldn't be absorbed by efficiencies. At the recent budget, the Treasury promised that the core government grant for police forces would increase, but did not say by how much.
Ministers have appointed a panel of experts to take part in an independent review of prison sentences in England and Wales, chaired by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk. People are being invited to submit their ideas for reform before the review presents its findings to the government next year. Will Vernon reports.
The independent review into sentencing is one of several approaches to tackle chronic overcrowding in prisons in England and Wales. The government has now appointed the panel of experts who will examine proposals to reform the system. The panel includes a retired Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, and Michael Spur, a former chief executive of the prison service. The review has appealed for suggestions and, over the next 8 weeks, members of the public are encouraged to share ideas for reform. The chair of the panel, David Gawk, said he welcomed responses that challenged current thinking, adding that the review would also look at examples of best practice from other countries.
Forecasters in Spain are warning there could be up to 5 inches of rain in parts of the Valencia region, a fortnight after flash flooding killed more than 200 people. The authorities have been urging residents to pause clean-up efforts to help stack sandbags. There have also been further downpours in Malaga, as Guy Hedgeco reports.
Malaga was the hardest hit area last night, with many streets under deep water and hospital workers having to bail water out of their building. The worst of the weather is believed to have passed there. A major tennis event, the Billie Jean King Cup, is due to get underway a day late. However, the region of Valencia is on red alert today as it faces a second wave of severe storms in just 2 weeks. This time, local people are better prepared because they've been forewarned, although there are fears that drainage systems already blocked by mud will not be able to manage the latest floods.
A prostate cancer charity says a national screening program for the disease would reverse a rise in the number of late diagnoses. Prostate Cancer Research says thousands more additional early diagnoses could improve survival rates and quality of life. The charity also points to the economic benefits of this approach through boosted productivity and reduced healthcare costs. England's football refereeing body has said it is taking new allegations against the Premier League official David Coote very seriously. The Sun newspaper has published a video which it claims shows the referee taking drugs. He was suspended earlier this week after a video apparently showed him making derogatory comments about Liverpool's former manager Jurgen Klopp. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
The Sun has released footage which it says shows David Coote sniffing white powder through a rolled-up US banknote. The paper claims it was filmed during this summer's European Championships when he was working as a match official. The BBC has not independently verified the video. The referees body, PGMOL, said it was aware of the latest allegations and was taking them very seriously. It added that David Coote's welfare continued to be of the utmost importance. The referee was suspended from his role on Monday after a separate video emerged, allegedly showing him repeatedly swearing and making derogatory comments about Jurgen Klopp, calling the former Liverpool manager arrogant. The BBC has approached David Coote for comment.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 9 minutes past seven. The Chancellor's speech at Mansion House in London this evening may feel a welcome distraction for Rachel Reeves from the continuing fallout over her October budget. Perhaps the fiercest of those rows concerns the changes she made to inheritance tax for large farms, where those worth over £1 million will face a rate of 20%, having previously been exempt. It's a row we expect to see on the streets with protests planned for next week, but it is one that has now spread to the corridors of Whitehall. My colleague Nick Watt reports that the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, as it's known, has been pressing the Treasury for a softening of the rules to exclude those aged over 80, a request that has so far been denied. Well, on the Today podcast this week, Nick and Amol have been speaking to James Rebanks, the sheep farmer who has chronicled his life in Cumbria and the challenges faced by his community. And he's been describing what it was like listening to the Chancellor make those changes affecting farmers in the budget.
What I really felt as I listened to it was, oh no, please don't do this. Like, just don't do this. This is a mistake. And not a mistake because I'm unduly worried about James Dyson or Jeremy Clarkson paying their fair share of tax or other wealthy people or even great estates, but because I knew that that budget was a really, really pivotal moment in terms of our relationship between the British government and the British public and farmers. Because we've just gone through this tumultuous period of about 10 years where we've changed our relationship with farmers. And farmers have taken a series of beatings which set the context for this budget. And I just prayed that they wouldn't make the mistakes they've made.
Let's speak now to Clive Bailey, who's a farmer in Lichfield in Staffordshire and the founder of the Farming Forum, who are organising a protest next week against the measures announced in the budget. Good morning, Clive.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Could I just start with that idea of that exemption that one department had been pushing for that could be for those over the age of 80, those farmers and farm owners? Would you welcome that?
Well, anything would be a step forward, even the fact that they were, you know, at least acknowledging that maybe they had got a lot of the numbers wrong and needed to revisit them. I mean, I would say 80. I mean, 80's very old, isn't it? A bit of a stat for you. I think it's 38% of working farmers are over 68 years old. So that puts, I think that compares to 4% in the wider working population. So that means, you know, there's a lot of people that should have been retired already still working. I would say, you know, if they went down that kind of road, maybe not an exemption, just change the rules on gifting so people have got time to get their affairs in order. At the moment, you need to live 7 years that to be the case. I'd suggest something like, you know, 2 years after the age of 67 or something like that, perhaps.
That would be the suggestion on the age side of things. What would be what you're looking to hear from the government to be able to call off your protest next week?
Well, ideally, a complete U-turn on the whole thing. It's so misthought out, and the numbers that really give that away. So I think at the absolute minimum, they need to sit down with some real family farmers, you know, people like myself or agricultural economists, and they need to look at the actual amount of money that is invested, the capital required to run even the most marginal of viable family farms, and change those reliefs at the very minimum. I mean, realistically, the figures are a 5 or 10 million just to be, you know, and that's not a big farm these days when a tractor's £250,000 and a combine's £500,000, and you could have a, you know, easily have £500,000 of livestock on a farm.
If I could come in at this point though, and for instance, Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies has said that the changes announced by the Chancellor will affect a remarkably small number of some of the most valuable farms. He says farms are still more generously treated actually than farms used to be in decades past. Fewer than 500 farms a year expected to be affected, and in reality tax experts say only farms worth over £3 million will be affected. What do you make of that?
It's ridiculous. I've heard this so many times now, and it's just no more than political soundbiting, basically. The £1 million actually makes what they're trying to solve worse, because a one million or even a £2 million farm is not a viable family farm. It's a lifestyle. So it's a small holding or a house in the country with a pony paddock, you know, topped up by a second income or money that's been made in other industries. And those are the people that have been abusing the APR, the agricultural property relief rules. That's not genuine real farmers, because trust me, you can't, that's not enough capital invested to make a viable family farm. And I mean, a 10 million investment, which is a huge amount of money, I understand, but it's not really money. Farmers don't think in pounds, shilling and pence. We talk about how many acres we farm, how many cows we've got. The land's not for sale. And the only way that it's possible to pay that 20% tax bill on death of a next generation, it's not payable out of what you're making, because, you know, even out of that £10 million of asset, that farmer might only be, you know, earning enough minimum wage type levels and less than 1% return on capital. No other industry's like that. That's why farming's different. We're not special, but the economic circumstances of farming are very different to wider industry.
And as it stands, those protests are going ahead next week. And you are a big part of the organisation of that. Clive, we're going to have to leave it there. Clive Bailey, a farmer in Lichfield, and you were listening before to the words of James Rebounce talking to Nick and Amol on the Today podcast, which you can catch in full, that conversation, on BBC Sounds.
It is coming up to 7:15. As we heard in the news, the Chancellor will outline plans for what she calls 8 pension mega funds in her first Mansion House speech to city leaders later. Will is back with more than that. Hi, Will.
Hiya, Johnny. Yeah, that's right. In what Rachel Reeves has called the biggest pension reform in decades, 86 different local authority pension funds that manage £354 billion in investments will be pooled into 8, the Chancellor says, to try and generate better returns and boost investment in UK companies and infrastructure. Tracy Blackwell is the Chief Executive of the Pension Insurance Corporation. Tracy, morning.
Morning.
You've been part of a kind of task force with the Treasury for a number of years around ways, I guess, to get pension funds working better for the wider economy. What do you make of what you've heard outlined?
Well, we think it's a really important step in the right direction in the case of LGPS, for the taxpayers, and for savers in the case of DC. And it really mirrors what's already happened in the defined benefit private sector world, as schemes move to insurance, and we can use our economies of scale and expertise to invest in complex projects in the UK. But it doesn't solve all the issues, but it is very much a step in the right direction.
LGPS, by the way, the local government pension schemes, and DC defined contributions as well. That we heard a little bit of concern from Gervase Williams a little bit earlier on at 6 o'clock, head of equities at Premier Miton. This was Gervase's concern.
I'm disappointed, actually, that the pension schemes of the local authorities are being consolidated. They've always been able to invest in big companies, but also small companies. And I think with this consolidation, these mega funds, by implication, they'll invest in mega companies, and many of the smaller companies will be, unfortunately, less significant.
Do you think that's a valid concern, Tracy?
No, I don't. I think by having the scale and the right expertise internally to invest in a wide range of assets, they'll be able to invest in a lot more than they can than what they can invest in now. I think it'll actually widen their investment horizons.
And it's risk that's always been the counterbalance to all of this, right? That, you know, if you're investing in younger startup companies that perhaps something goes wrong, they go bust. That's a problem in terms of paying out those pension contributions that you have to people when they retire.
Yeah, it is. But there's another part of this, especially with local government pension schemes, and that is the risk to the taxpayer of the current situation and the current system. So local government pension schemes, if they're all combined together, are the same size as the largest Canadian scheme, which, as we've seen yesterday, there was a Canadian scheme that invested in some of the UK airports, which the UK schemes cannot do right now, just because they don't have the expertise. The cost to the UK taxpayer of local government pension schemes is about twice as much as the equivalent Canadian scheme. And the performance differential is also very substantial. So it's really the taxpayer who will benefit from all of this.
Tracy Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Pension Insurance Corporation. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Will. It's 18 minutes past seven. The Spanish region of Malaga is feeling the lash of terrible rain and floods. It was Valencia, of course, that saw the worst floods a couple of weeks ago when more than 220 people died. The streets of Malaga are awash, but thankfully there's been nothing like the death and destruction seen before. Schools and universities will stay shut today. Road and rail traffic has been disrupted. Let's talk to someone bracing for the rising waters, Jackie Ross, who owns the Last Chance Animal Resource Centre with her daughter in Pizarra in Malaga. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Good morning.
Can you tell me how things are right now?
Right now, heavy rain again. I'm sitting here and it's really, really coming down. It's just really frightening here at the moment, not knowing what to expect and what's going to happen.
Is the rain washing away, or is it visible in the streets? Have you got the sort of flooded streets that there were before?
Oh, we've got flooded streets, and 2 weeks ago we got our animal rescue was completely washed away here. We were in the process of clearing that up when we got the red alert that this is coming again.
So tell me about the clear up that you had to do. I mean, we saw pictures previously of Valencia that were disastrous. Was it the same kind of situation for you?
Yeah, it was just like that. We stepped out of the heavy rains, 2 weeks ago. We stepped out of the shelter, stupidly enough, to go and buy some Wellington boots for the staff. And we got a phone call when we got about 4 minutes down the road to say, you'd better get back here quick, which was lucky that we were out, because it was the only transport vehicle that actually survived what was can only be described as like a small tsunami that came from the river straight across our land and took everything that we've got.
And you've been clearing up since then, presumably, have you?
We had a huge clear-up going on. And then all of a sudden we get this red alert 2 weeks after the fact, when we were just beginning to see the clearance working, and it's hit us again. Luckily, so far, the river hasn't burst its banks again, but we are flooded out again from the sheer quantity of rain that's fallen on us.
So what happens when the red alert comes? Does that mean get out? Does it mean find higher ground? Does it mean go up a few floors if you've got them?
What we were advised, the red alert came on everyone's phone. And if we were in specific areas, we were told to contact the emergency services. We contacted them and said, look, we've been told to evacuate here. We've got 80 dogs and 20 cats, and we've been told to get out. We can't just get out. Yeah. And they just said, well, you've got to. You, the humans, have got to leave. And I said, well, I'm not going. Sorry, I can't go. I can't leave 80 dogs and 20 cats.
No, I mean,
get them out.
I was going to ask, I mean, how are the animals faring? I mean, how are they? Oh, I think that very small click on the line suggests that we have lost Jackie Ross of the Last Chance Animal Resource Centre, describing her travails there. That swing from drought to floods was prompted by absolutely biblical rainfall, and it's led to a lot of comment, obviously, about climate change. Not a lot of surprise, it has to be said, from climate scientists who have been warning for years that a warming world will lead to more violent weather events. Professor Simon Lewis is Professor of Global Change Science at University College London. He joins us. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
Can I just ask you, first of all, whether you were surprised? Because I know a lot of people were when they saw what happened in Valencia. Were you surprised, or did you think, well, this is what was always going to happen?
I mean, it was an awful, awful catastrophe, but yeah. To me, it was not a surprise. We have record fossil fuel emissions, record temperatures, and therefore we're going to see more extreme and more frequent extreme weather events.
And again, why is that? Because, I mean, people may not make the connection, the direct connection between what they see as a very gently warming climate and perceive as that, and this extraordinarily violent weather events.
Yes, well, warmer air can hold more moisture. So as we have warming temperatures, we have this warmer air and we can have bigger downpours. So what we saw in Valencia was, you know, a year's rainfall in just 8 hours, an astonishing event, but it's kind of supercharged by climate change. And the bigger picture is all of the places where we live, they have been built up over decades and in many places centuries to withstand a certain sort of climate and a certain sort of environmental conditions. And as we push the climate with fossil fuels, then we push outside of that envelope where we can kind of deal with the normal rainfall, and we get these extreme events, whether they be rainfall or drought or heat waves, that pushes outside of the kind of tolerances of the places that we live, and therefore we see these like awful disasters like we've seen in Valencia.
Is there part of you as a climate scientist and someone who presumably fears for the planet if we continue along this path, is there part of you that sees the floods and thinks, well, that might at least change people's perception of climate change and its impact?
I mean, I hope so. Like, I really, really hope so. But I'm not sure. You know, we had a heat wave in Europe in 2003 that caused at least 50,000 excess deaths. And it didn't put us on a new path. Mm. But I think for this crisis, it has a potential, because if it's a long political backlash, then maybe politicians will take note. And maybe if it's a long enough and a harsh enough political backlash, then politicians outside of Spain will notice it and think that this is important, that we get a real grip on this.
Professor Simon Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
It's 24 minutes past seven.
Now, should you have the good fortune to sample the seas in the glorious southwest of England, then you might also have the great good luck to see a bluefin tuna rising above the waters. Once listed as an endangered species, these majestic creatures have made an astonishing return to our waters. Dr. Abigail McQuatters-Gollop is Associate Professor of Marine Conservation at the University of Plymouth. Good morning, Abigail.
Good morning.
How is it they are back?
I mean, it's really amazing, isn't it, that they're back? So in the kind of 80s and 90s, the Atlantic bluefin tuna were really, really overfished. And then we started managing them better, working with lots of other countries, and their population has increased and they're becoming more abundant now. And one of the consequences of that is that they've moved back into UK waters where they've been absent for like nearly 100 years.
Should you be in the water, if you were happening to be in the water and you weren't a tuna expert, how would you know you were next to a bluefin?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure if you'd be able to tell exactly, but I would say that if you're, you know, swimming in the water on a boat around the southwest of the UK and you see tuna jumping out, it's probably bluefin, and you'd be really, really lucky to see them. I haven't seen them and I'm dying to.
I wish you luck with that. Just briefly, if you would. I mean, they don't just hang around Britain. It has been a big international effort, hasn't it, to try and protect the bluefin tuna?
Yeah, their range is really amazing. So we think the tuna that live around the UK, we think they breed in the Mediterranean. They spawn in the Mediterranean. So they come all the way through the Strait of Gibraltar, all the way around the Iberian Peninsula to live around the UK. And so they also mix with the North American tuna. So the organization that manages tuna called ICAT, there's like 51 countries that all work together to manage these tuna. So it's an amazing like international effort and a success story also.
Yeah, a real genuine success story, and one which British swimmers, if they're incredibly lucky, presumably, will be able to enjoy too.
Yeah, I hope so. Send photos if you see some.
Send photos. Dr. Abigail Mokotas-Gollop, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, we'll get on that, won't we, Johnny? It's 7 minutes past seven, but Carthy's here with the sport.
Morning, thank you. Football headlines to start. The England men's captain, Harry Kane, has expressed his disappointment that nine players have withdrawn from the latest international squad, insisting England comes before club. Kane's criticism is ahead of tonight's Nations League game against Greece. The Republic of Ireland host Finland tonight before facing England on Sunday. And last night, Chelsea women beat Celtic 2-1 in the Champions League to remain top of their group. Now, the most successful sprinter in cycling history, Sir Mark Cavendish, called time on his 19-year career at the weekend with yet another victory, this time in the Tour de France Criterium in Singapore. Cavendish is the record holder for all-time Tour de France stage wins. He has an Olympic silver medal and multiple world titles. And I've been speaking to him about his decision to retire.
I've done everything I can do in the sport and more. Like, I'm very happy. I continued riding because I loved it. And it's nice to be going out on a fairy tale, I think, as a professional athlete. There's not many athletes like really get to go out with a fairy tale ending. And I'm very fortunate of being in that position. And it's time to not hurt myself every day, I guess.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that about going out on a high. I've spoken to a lot of sports people about what a difficult decision it is to make. Andy Murray particularly articulated that this summer, saying that he wanted to continue. He loves his sport like you love your sport. What are your immediate plans now that you have retired for a few days?
Well, I've already flown to the US. I've got some stuff going on, and it's a lot of stuff for riding bike, like charity rides and out with groups of people, you know, and just sharing that love of what I have for the bike as a sport, as a mode of transport, as a pastime. It's the most incredible thing to do. I've always got a sense of freedom. I like seeing people get that same enjoyment from a bicycle as I do. But to spend time with my family would be the most important thing. I'm quite sad. My six-year-old boy did his first race, actually, the day that I announced my retirement. So the day before I did my last race, he did his first race. And what an incredibly proud moment. But it was obviously I was sad because I couldn't be there, you know. But yeah, I won't be one of those parents that lives their career through their kid. But at least now I can put time into his ride and then the other kids what they want to do. I always need a goal. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning, and whether that's on the bike or not on the bike. I think ultimately I still want to be in cycling and I want to make a difference in cycling. And so I work towards that. You just won't be getting up in whatever weather conditions and having to limit what I have for breakfast now.
I was going to ask you about that. You have been very honest about your clinical depression diagnosis, and retirement is difficult, as you just mentioned, for anybody. Have you planned to keep a very focused schedule, or are you looking forward to not having structure in your life now, or a slightly different structure in your life?
I'll always have structure. I need that. And I don't really know any other way. My life doesn't change. I just don't ride a bike. Do you know what I mean? It's as simple as that. I think it's just shifting what you do without getting out and ride. I think it actually could be a little bit difficult because obviously I have to fit riding a bike now round anything else I do, like anyone else has to do. You know, like when people always said to me, like, what? How are you on your bike for that many hours a day? Hang on, you go to work and you probably go on your bike before or after it. That's harder than just riding your bike in the day, you know? And I can ride my bike on my own with my own thoughts or with somebody else without having to do a set program, you know? It's actually quite nice.
My final question is just about, I saw a few years ago how much you were sort of emotional and understood Eliud Kipchoge being the first sub 2-hour marathon runner. When you're the world's best at something, which you are, which are the other athletes that you admire the most or look at and think that is an ultimate achievement?
Athletes are very fortunate to do what they love as a job, but the sacrifices you have to do to put in to be the best is it's a small club that understands that, really, you know, and you really understand it between everybody else, and when they put their life into something, it seems to be you get it and you know they get you, you know, and through the good and bad, I guess, you know, and it gives you massive respect for all sport.
Yeah, well, we've enjoyed watching you being one of the world's best. Mark Cavendish, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
And just to mention cricket, England's men are 2-0 ahead in their T20 series with West Indies. The third match is later today, and we'll be speaking to Johnny Grave, the outgoing chief executive of Cricket West Indies, about the business behind that special brand of cricket later.
On BBC iPlayer.
You is a homosexual, Barry.
I am a barisexual.
Based on the novel from the Booker Prize winner Bernardine Evaristo.
What happened to us, Barry?
Life happened, Carmen.
Do you know what Mum thinks the problem is? You don't like women.
We are in this for life.
I have to tell her my truth.
No more sneaking around.
Mr. Loverman.
You're about to burst into song.
I might, because I want to sing your name into the night.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Looking forward to that. Let's just have a look at the weather. Today, we'll see any early low cloud. Fog and mist soon lift to leave a dry day with a mix of variable clouds and sunny spells for most. A gentle wind will be associated. There you go.
Can't beat a good gentle wind. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett. Now a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has announced changes to pensions that she says will unlock tens of billions of pounds worth of investment in the UK. The measures include merging dozens of local government schemes into what have been described as mega funds. Critics say the plans could put savers' money at risk. A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the tougher rules announced in the budget, but its appeal has been rejected by the Treasury. A group representing about half of the UK's independent pharmacies has warned that members could reduce opening hours from January after they voted in favour of industrial action for the first time. The National Pharmacy Association, which has members in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, is calling for a funding increase of about £1.7 billion a year. The Department of Health covering England said the system had been neglected for too long. The Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police says the force is on the verge of eye-watering cuts to its services because of a lack of funding. Sir Mark Rowley told the Political Thinking podcast that options to balance the books, such as selling police stations, had run out. The Treasury promised at the budget the core government grant for police forces would increase, but didn't say by how much. People in Valencia have woken to blue skies after fears of a return of heavy rain. More than 200 people were killed in flash flooding 2 weeks ago. There has been rain in the Malaga region, with schools and universities closed for the day. A prostate cancer charity says a national screening programme for the disease would reverse a rise in the number of late diagnoses. Prostate Cancer Research says thousands more additional early diagnoses could improve survival rates and quality of life.
Jane, thank you for that. And to that point, every 45 minutes, one man dies from prostate cancer. That's more than 12,000 men every year. But there isn't a national screening programme for the disease in the UK. It has been front of some minds more recently after the Olympic legend Sir Chris Hoy, who has revealed his terminal prostate cancer diagnosis, has been talking about it, prompting the Health Secretary to say he will review guidance around testing in NHS England. But today, a report from Prostate Cancer Research will be presented at the House of Commons, trying to show the economic benefits of a national screening programme. Well, Nick Jones, founder of Soho House and now a trustee of Prostate Cancer Research, discovered he had prostate cancer 2 years ago. And in a moment, I'll be talking to Professor Caroline Moore, a consultant urologist specialising in the detection, surveillance and the minimally invasive treatment of prostate cancer. So a warm welcome to you both. But Nick, if I can start with you. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did you discover it?
Well, both my parents had had cancer, so I went looking and I had a very diligent private GP who every 6 months I went and got blood tests, and one of the blood tests came back and my PSA wasn't that high, but it was high enough to alert him to send me to an MRI. I went and had an MRI. The MRI came back and there was an enormous tumour on the right-hand side of my prostate. Then I had a biopsy, which proved that it was cancerous, and then it was a big discussions about what should happen at that stage, because there is a menu of options of what to have.
And I mean, I suppose your point there, and we'll come on to this, is you were looking for it. Many are not.
I was looking for it, yes.
And being very vigilant because of your family history. Yes. But what was that like to learn that you had that? Because, you know, a lot of men, we were hearing about this earlier from the chief executive of the charity that you're now a trustee of, you know, brag about not going to the doctor, feel a bit squeamish about all of this.
Well, I feel I'm very lucky. And at my luck, what I want to do with it is talk a lot about prostate cancer, not make it feel embarrassing, make it feel like a everyday conversation. And I also want everyone, not just me who could go to a private doctor, but everyone who can't afford to go to a private doctor should have exactly the same screening as I have.
And let's come to that, but just how was it to be diagnosed, even though you were searching
It is not a very nice feeling, as everyone, and there's hundreds of thousands of people diagnosed with cancer every year worldwide. You don't know what to do.
You must have been particularly scared because you lost your parents.
I was scared, frightened, and all that waiting between knowing that you had something to be exactly what you had.
And you're well now because you took the action to have your prostate removed.
My prostate taken out, and I'm full and healthy, and you know everything is back to normal.
Again, that's another fear. Men, you know, worry about some issues afterwards around, you know, urinary incontinence and whether things will, you know, be the same and work.
And these are good things to talk about, you know, because men don't like
talking
about...
I'm bringing them up here with you on the radio.
Men don't like talking about these things. But yes, there are problems with erections, and there's problems with going to the loo, but they're all recoverable. But it's much better than being dead.
And... well, you know, putting it like that, and also, I suppose, if you can have the support of those around you to help you through that time. I mean, I should say your wife's voice quite familiar to Radio 4 listeners, the one and only Kirsty Young. But she herself at the same time was going through, because she recently came on the programme, her own health issues. So it was something I'm sure was very difficult to traverse.
It was a lot of discussion. But also, you know, Kirsty gets a letter in the post at the age of 50 asking her to go for a mammogram.
Let's get on to that. Let me bring in Professor Caroline Moore. Why don't we have a national screening programme? When you hear those statistics about men, putting aside how men can be about going to the doctor, and Nick there, you know, talking about something that men don't find easy, why don't we have it?
Thanks. So it's really that the big screening studies to date have been based on the old-fashioned tests of the PSA blood test and a finger examination by a doctor. The next step was to do a standard transrectal biopsy. So we're not sure where the cancer is. We'll take some samples. And then to treat the prostate with either taking it out or radiotherapy to the whole prostate. Now, we know that there's been massive improvements. So the standard of care in NHS England is that for men with a high PSA blood test, you now get an MRI, so that about a third of men can be safely reassured that they don't need the biopsy. And for those men that need a biopsy, they can have a targeted biopsy to be better at finding the cancers that need treating.
But I suppose that's the pathway once you're on it. But yes. Why don't we have a route to getting to it? Because, you know, this idea of it's informed choice. You go to the doctor if you know you're at higher risk. Why don't we have that proactive step that we seem to have for women in certain cases? We certainly don't in all cases for women, but in some of cases.
So it's really because that comes under the remit of the National Screening Committee. They need to look at large-scale studies. And the large-scale studies of tens of thousands of men used the old tests. So what we need is a study and an analysis, and the new report is very helpful in that, in looking at what happens if we use the new tests.
Because you don't want false positives, you want the best way of doing this. But Nick, coming back to your experience, you know, your side of things was very vigilant, using the private doctors. You know, for you now, having gone through this, you've obviously very passionate about trying to get this to change.
I'm very passionate, and I do look at the brilliant women back in the 80s who fought hard, campaigned hard to get mammograms. And from that, every woman now gets a letter at the age of 50 for a mammogram. And it saved tens of thousands of lives. All I'm asking for, and so many people are asking for, is that men get the same right for a screening at the age of 45, if you're a black man and because you have it in the family.
It's more common, yes. And where it's in cases where it can be more common.
More common, and 50 for everyone else.
And are you meeting resistance?
There is resistance, but we're dealing with that resistance. And the resistance is usually around over-treatment. Now, my view on over-treatment is I would much rather have a bit of over-treatment and save so many lives on the other side.
What's the concern about over-treatment, Caroline?
So that's when we diagnose a small cancer, and if we don't have MRI, we say it's a small cancer, but it may be bigger. And so we say, have your prostate out or have radiotherapy. And then we find, oh, it was only a small cancer. We could have left it alone. But MRI helps us with that because it helps us to risk stratify men, and there's much less overtreatment. So the UK has the lowest levels of treatment for small low risk cancers throughout the world, and that's because we're so good at using MRI after a PSA blood test.
Is it an interesting experience having found Soho House becoming a health campaigner now? This is a new line for you.
This is a new line because I really want to save lives. You know, we could. Overnight, 6,000 lives could be saved a year. Families, that's fathers, brothers, uncles, you know, colleagues.
And are you seeing men open saved. Up a bit more about
and
they, this?
And opening up, this could happen. And, you know, we have a health secretary who is very keen on preventative medicine, and this falls straight into that. This has to happen. It can't not happen. And I just do want to point out, because it hasn't been pointed out, that Caroline actually was the team, headed the team behind making the MRI pick up prostate cancer 10 years ago. So thank you for saving my life.
You're very kind. We're a big team.
It's a lovely moment. Sorry to be able to. Well, it's lovely to have it here, and sorry it's over now for that. But you'll be continuing talking, I'm sure, much we more. Will. But also, I think it's really important to get that message out about how examinations have changed and the first wave of testing, if you indeed go for it. Nick Jones, Professor Caroline Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
It is 17 minutes to 8. This year's Heritage at Risk Register has been revealed today. It's the snapshot published by Historic England of England's historic buildings, what might be under threat of being lost. The fluctuations in the list are not all bad news. When a building or a site is saved or restored, it comes off the register. And one of those happily departing the list was Beaurepaire Priory in County Durham, a manor house used by monks and priors from Durham Cathedral. Rebecca Watkins is from Dream Heritage alongside the local community in Durham. Dream Heritage helped organise Beaurepaire's restoration. She sent us this.
I'm at the wonderful ruins of Beaurepaire Medieval Manor House, which is set in the backdrop of the lovely Brownie Valley. The ruins of the manor house themselves, made of a very sort of grey limestone. They would have been whitewashed at some point, all of different heights and levels, with the tallest bit being a surviving buttress. And right now I'm stood on top of the hill where the manor house looks out across the landscape all the way to Langley Park and Lanchester and Neville's Cross and Ushaw Moor. I was a student at Durham University. About 10 years ago, I was staying with a lovely local family in the village of Broome Park. I got invited to go on a walk. They took me to this wonderful site when it was just completely overgrown and kind of unrecognisable to what it is today. They said, "What is it?" And I said, "I have no idea." And they're like, "But you do archaeology." And I was like, "I still don't know what it is," because it was that sort of forgotten place. It required quite a lot of research and history and conversations with local people to bring its heritage and its importance back to life.
Well, that was Rebecca Watkins of Dream Heritage on a site saved and restored. Duncan Wilson, Chief Executive of Historic England, is here in the studio. Good morning, Duncan.
Morning.
What is the register and how and why does a building get on it?
Well, it's an assessment by our expert staff, most of whom are based out in the regions, in regional offices, and local authorities, conservation officers, private individuals can notify us of a building that is considered to be at risk of serious damage.
Right, and the notification comes, you check it, and you say, yes, this is in bad enough condition
exactly.
to go on to it. And then what happens? How does being on the register actually help the building?
Well, you do qualify for grant. I mean, we have a relatively small budget. We spent £8 million last year on on Heritage at Risk to try and save it. But also it draws people's attention to it and engages with the local community, and that's what saves buildings.
And this list does fluctuate. It tells us where we are right now, but some buildings are getting saved.
Yes, they are, absolutely.
Can you tell us about this?
Well, I've got one particular one where actually Sherborne House in Dorset, my father tried to save it 30 years ago. He's dead now, and it's quite heartwarming for me to see we finally got there. It's a wonderful Georgian house with paintings by Sir James Thornhill. Used to be a girls' school, was abandoned, and after 30 years, the right group of people got together to save it.
And are these properties, forgive my ignorance, are they always abandoned and sort of crumbling and over?
No, no, sometimes they can be occupied, but, you know, conservation of heritage is a big job, and it's getting bigger because construction price inflation and other things are affecting it. So we see the need to help, and often it's advice people need as well as money.
And the Bow Repair Priory, which we were hearing about earlier, was saved not just with this group Dream Heritage, but with also local people getting very heavily involved. How easy is it for, sort of, I suppose, what you might call amateurs, lay people, to get involved with?
Well, you can go to our website and look up the Heritage at Risk Register, which has thousands of entries, and see what's in your area. But it's word of mouth. It's talking to your local conservation officer. It's talking to our office.
Yeah.
Do get in touch if you think there's something that ought to be on the register that we're not aware of.
And there is a role for people to actively get involved in saving these, or is that more down to getting experts in?
Both, actually. Right. You will need expert advice on the repairs, but it there's no substitute for personal engagement, personal involvement, passion to saving a building. And often the ones that are saved have just a small group of people who stick at it, and that's what we want to encourage.
Duncan Wilson from Historic England, thank you very much.
Thank you.
At 12 minutes to 8, it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Jasveer Singh from the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. This weekend, Sikhs will be marking the birth anniversary of Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith. As a social reformer who sincerely believed that people from different backgrounds and beliefs could work together for the common good, it's fitting that this year's celebrations fall in the midst of Interfaith Week. Guru Nanak was born 555 years ago. He travelled extensively around Asia and the Middle East with his close friend Mardana, who was a loyal companion of the Guru and yet lived and died an observant Muslim. Together they travelled to many Hindu, Jain, Buddhist and Muslim pilgrimage sites, with the Guru sharing a message of unity and oneness wherever he went. In fact, the first line of scripture composed by the Guru is, "There is but one creator and truth is its name." Guru Nanak's interfaith encounters shaped Sikhi. At Mecca, the Guru is said to have engaged in deep philosophical discussions with a Ghazi, or Islamic judge, about the omnipotence of the Almighty. At the Ganges, the Guru spoke with Hindu pilgrims about the futility of meaningless rituals. From the wealthiest merchants to those who owned only the clothes they wore, he treated all with the same humility and respect. On one occasion, Guru Nanak visited the town of Multan. The holy men of the area sent him a bowl filled to the brim with milk. Their message was that the town was full to the brim with religious figures and had room for no more. Guru Nanak responded by placing a jasmine flower on top of the milk without spilling a drop from the bowl. His response was clear. His presence would add to the religious environment of Multan in the same way that the flower had added its perfume and essence to the milk. Guru Nanak believed in the importance of dialogue and discourse, even with people who hated him or with whom he vehemently disagreed. His compassionate view of the world meant he saw everyone as equals in the eyes of the Almighty, and therefore as equals to each other. Five centuries on, and in our world of social media echo chambers, we can become convinced that we are entirely right and faultless, whilst others are absolutely wrong and completely to blame for the ills in society. Yet Guru Nanak's teachings remind us of the value of nuanced debate and listening to the views of others. As he said, "I am not good, no one is bad." The world is not a binary space of right and wrong, good and bad, but a place of great awe and wonder. We have much to learn from one another, even if we don't ultimately agree. The power of reason, discussion, with respect for differences can never be underestimated.
That was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh from the Faiths Forum for London. It is 8:09, and Team Trump is taking shape day by day, and most days the announcements are causing some fairly sharp intakes of breath. Today, it's the turn of his pick for Attorney General, the man who will run the Department of Justice, a department which, of course, has a significant interest in Mr. Trump himself, or did so. Matt Gaetz is a firebrand congressman who will be the new Attorney General, so long as he gets confirmed by the Senate. That pick, alongside others, came as it was projected that Mr. Trump and his party will have control not just of the White House, not just of the Senate, but also of the House of Representatives, giving him a clean sweep of the legislature and the executive, and certainly easing the path of any legislation Mr. Trump may wish to pass. Congressman Glenn S. Grothman is a Republican who serves as the US representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. I began by asking him about the recent Trump appointments.
I think several legislators here, or former legislators, which is kind of enjoyable for a congressman because they're people we already know. You know, frequently don't know the cabinet agencies. But here, even somebody like Lee Zeldin, who has been in the legislature for a few years now, it's great to see him part of the administration. Matt Gaetz is somebody else who we all know, and it shows that I think President Trump wants to shake things up. He's seen the worst of the Department of Justice. And I think Matt Gaetz has the personality to not be intimidated by the bureaucracy that's been around there forever and, quite frankly, has not treated President Trump fairly.
We read, Congressman, of some surprise amongst some Republican lawmakers, as well as Democrat lawmakers, about Matt Gaetz's nomination on things he's done in the past and perhaps some lack of experience with the law as well. He has a law degree and did practice, but not for long.
I think that's true, but I think what President Trump is looking for is the attitude. Matt Gaetz is not intimidated by people. The Attorney General is not going in there trying cases like a local district attorney in a American county would. He's going in there to administer the agency as a whole, to get rid of the people who he feels are the problem children. I'm looking forward to Matt being there. There are things I want to give him to do that I think perhaps were not handled properly in past administrations. Perhaps they're discriminating against certain sorts of people in there. I look forward to Matt having that job.
I guess there will be some in the Justice Department who will be crying politicization at this point, when someone like Mr. Gaetz comes into the job. Are they wrong?
I will say this. Donald Trump is a different sort of president. The American public wanted a different sort of president, and a different sort of president sometimes has different sorts of appointees. And I think Matt will go after things the way other appointees would not.
The appointments come as your party, the president's party, is projected to win control of the House, which will give it the House, the Senate, and the White House. I'm sure that cheers you. Does it? It makes the path of President Trump's policy proposals that much easier, doesn't it, to have the legislature as well as the executive? It gives him a sweep.
Some of them, not all of them, because we have a rule in the Senate, a filibuster rule, that I believe the Senate Republicans will keep going, which means for most bills, it's going to take 60 votes to pass the Senate. So even though you think, well, the Republicans have the Senate, the House, and the presidency, so they can get done whatever they want, as long as they stick with a filibuster rule, that's not true. We can get through tax cuts on our own. We can get through changes in what we call mandatory spending on our own. But we cannot just shove through any policy changes that we want. It is going to disappoint some of our Republican followers who think we can do whatever we want. I am assuming the Republicans in the Senate, being very much traditionalists, I think some people in there are going to stick with the old filibuster rule, which is to say, to change policy, we need 60 senators. I'm not thrilled with that decision, but I think that's the decision they'll reach.
There is talk that this transition, the early days of this new administration are clearly going to be a lot more organised than the last time, back in 2016-2017, and that means the plans for government will be implemented that much better and that much more swiftly. Do you have faith? Do you think, from what you see in these early days, that this is a much more organised effort by President Trump and the people around him, and it's going to be much more effective as a result of that?
I think so. I think some of the establishment sorts really felt they were better than President Trump, which they weren't. But now he's got his own people in there. I mean, what fun is it? Or it must not be enjoyable to be president and wind up having some of your appointees kind of backstab you or think they're better than you are. And I think this time around, President Trump will have appointees who aren't loyal to him. I mean, he'll listen to them. You know, it'll affect the decision he makes. But ultimately, they are pleased and proud to be working for the Trump administration.
Representative Glenn Grothman, thank you very much indeed.
Now, there's some monkey business lined up for you for later this morning.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
And this is the Infinite Monkey Hedgerow.
He was unable to write a funny joke for the introduction. That's amazing.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Science with funny bits.
Science with bits.
Funny science plus bits. So the reason that the Neanderthals died out, you're claiming, is because they weren't astronomers.
Is that...
Yes, exactly. That's why. This is how we investigate cybercrime. We look for the yachts.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts this morning at 11.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather with Stavden Ailes.
Thanks very much, Johnny and Emma. Good morning to you. Well, high pressure continues to dominate the weather scene today and tomorrow. Winds will be light from the north, but we will see quite a bit of cloud around. A few weak weather fronts are loitering, and that's going to bring some patchy light rain or drizzle like we've seen over the last few hours. Sunshine will become limited through this afternoon and into tomorrow. But into the weekend, we'll start to see some changes. Low pressure to the north of the UK will start to allow winds to pick up from the northwest. We could see some rain. Strong cold northerlies begin to develop later on Sunday, and then all areas will be cold next week, and there's a chance of some sleet and snow in places. Some of it could be disruptive. You have to stay tuned to the forecast for the details on that. Today, though, in a bit more detail for Scotland, it's been a cold start across parts of central eastern Scotland. Around Aberdeenshire, Braemar's temperatures down to -3 Celsius, and mist and fog. Elsewhere across Scotland, though, a lot of cloud around and milder, with temperatures into around 12 degrees Celsius mark, and also some patchy drizzle. Into the afternoon, see a little bit of sunshine across eastern Scotland, otherwise it stays mostly cloudy. Northern Ireland, mostly cloudy, starts some patchy drizzle around. See a little bit of sunshine into the afternoon, but I think it'll stay mostly cloudy. England and Wales, a lot of cloud to start off with, some drizzle too. Chilly conditions across northern England, where we've also had some mist and fog, some dense fog through Lancashire into Cumbria and Northumberland. Many places will stay rather cloudy through the afternoon. Best the sunshine towards eastern England, and temperatures 11 to 14 Celsius.
Thanks very much for that, Stav. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Good to be with you, with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of November. The headlines this morning: millions of public sector pensions are to be moved into 8 mega funds to try to take advantage of investments with higher growth potential. BBC News has learned of a row at the heart of government about the changes to inheritance tax for farms, and some pharmacies could cut their opening hours in the new year after voting for industrial action.
And stay with us here on this programme, because coming up before nine, the answer to one of those eternal questions.
Is mummy or daddy the best reader?
I think mummy.
Definitely correct. Can school literacy programmes for children entice a new group of readers? Parents. We're talking to you, if that includes you. The BBC News Now, though, is read by Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is to set out what she's calling the biggest pension reform in decades, involving the merger of dozens of schemes into a handful of pension mega funds. The Treasury says the new funds will take advantage of their size to invest in assets with higher growth potential, helping to increase returns for pensioners and boost the economy. But some experts have warned that the success of the plan will depend heavily on the availability of new infrastructure projects to invest in. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
A fortnight on from a big tax and spend budget, the Chancellor now wants to talk about big reforms needed to grow the economy. She will announce new legislation to create pensions mega funds modelled on systems used overseas.
Australia and Canada probably have the best pension funds anywhere in the world. And the reason they're so successful is that they have a small number of mega funds that have the scale to be able to invest not just domestically, but indeed around the world.
Just this week, a Canadian public pension fund in effect bought three British airports to add to large chunks of UK infrastructure, which Canadian funds already have stakes in, from water companies to ports, shopping centres and science parks. The local government pension scheme currently has £360 billion in assets, 6.5 million members and is split across 86 different funds. It will be consolidated into 8 mega funds to promote domestic investments in infrastructure and high-tech startups that often outgrow the UK. Rachel Reeves will have to convince the business community about her growth plans after a backlash from retailers in the hospitality industry over the forthcoming rise to employer national insurance.
Gervase Williams, who's head of equities at the investment firm Premier Miton, told us he has concerns about the plan.
I'm disappointed, actually, that the pension schemes of the local authorities are being consolidated. They've always been able to invest in big companies, but also small companies. And I think with this consolidation, these mega funds, by implication, they'll invest in mega companies, and many of the smaller companies will be, unfortunately, less significant.
A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the tougher rules announced in the budget, but its appeal has been rejected by the Treasury. More from Newsnight's political editor, Nick Watt.
It's a good old Whitehall clash. In one corner stands the department representing the interests of farmers. It believes it was not properly consulted on the budget, which ended an inheritance tax exemption for farms. From April 2026, farms worth more than £1 million will face an effective rate of 20%. Farmers have warned that this will make it more difficult for families to pass estates down the generations. The Rural Affairs Department has suggested a softening which could exempt some older people, possibly those over 80. The April 2026 start for the policy means they may not have time to make use of existing rules to skip inheritance tax by passing on an asset 7 years before death. But Treasury sources have told BBC Newsnight there'll be no change in the budget policy.
A group representing about half of the UK's independent pharmacies has warned that members could reduce opening hours from January after they voted in favour of industrial action for the first time. The National Pharmacy Association says owners are overwhelmingly in favour of limiting services unless the government increases funding. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The National Pharmacy Association says almost all those who voted were in favour of cutting opening times to 40 hours a week, withdrawing free home deliveries of medicines and pulling out of some services such as addiction support. The NPA, which is not a trade union, argues that members in England have seen their government funding cut by 40% in the last decade, even though they're dispensing record levels of prescriptions and providing more clinical services for the NHS. Their counterparts in Wales and Northern Ireland have also voted in favour of action. The Department of Health covering England said community pharmacy had a vital role to play, but the system had been neglected for too long.
Ministers have appointed a panel of experts to take part in an independent review of prison sentences, chaired by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk. People are being invited to submit their ideas for reform before the review presents its findings to the government next year. Will Vernon reports.
The independent review into sentencing is one of several approaches to tackle chronic overcrowding in prisons in England and Wales. The government has now appointed the panel of experts who will examine proposals to reform the system. The panel includes a retired Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, and Michael Spur, a former chief executive of the prison service. The review has appealed for suggestions and, over the next 8 weeks, members of the public are encouraged to share ideas for reform. The chair of the panel, David Gawk, said he welcomed responses that challenged current thinking, adding that the review would also look at examples of best practice from other countries.
The charity Prostate Cancer Research has called for men born with a higher risk of developing the disease to be screened once they reach the age of 45. The government has asked the NHS to look again at whether a national screening programme should be introduced after the six-time Olympic cycling gold medalist Sir Chris Hoy revealed he'd been diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer. The chief executive of Prostate Cancer Research, Oliver Kemp, told us that finding and treating the disease early would save money in the long term.
We used to have a moral argument for screening, and we now have an economic one as well. By using the latest technology, we could diagnose 4,600 people early, giving them 100% chance of survival at stage one. And that would deliver a net economic benefit of £200 million.
Red alerts have been lifted this morning in parts of Spain hit by heavy rain, but there is still concern about the disruption being caused. Flash floods in Valencia 2 weeks ago left more than 200 people dead. The forecast for the area is for more rain, and downpours overnight in the southern province of Malaga have caused the closure of schools and sports centres. Jackie Ross was flooded out of the animal rescue centre she runs in Malaga 2 weeks ago and told this programme the situation there is still very bad.
It's really, really coming down. It's just really frightening here at the moment, not knowing what to expect and what's going to happen. When we were just beginning to see the clearance working, it's hit us again. The river hasn't burst its banks again, but we are flooded out again from the sheer quantity of rain.
The British Museum is to receive the highest value gift in the UK museum history, with the acquisition of Chinese ceramics worth up to £1 billion. Items being donated include a chicken cup used to serve wine for the Changhua Emperor. Our culture reporter Guy Lambert takes up the story.
Sitting on display in room 95 at the British Museum is a collection of various ceramics, including the blue and white David vases, said to be two of the best known Chinese porcelains in the world, and other items from Japan, Hong Kong and Europe. The collection belonged to the British businessman Sir Percival David and has been on loan to the museum for the past 15 years. Now, 1,700 pieces of the collection are to be donated by the trustees of the Sir Percival David Foundation. The donation will bring the museum's collection of Chinese ceramics to 10,000 pieces, making it one of the most important of its kind in a public institution outside the Chinese-speaking world.
More than 150 new sites have been added to Historic England's list of Heritage at Risk. The list now includes Tamworth Castle in Staffordshire and Waltham Windmill in Lincolnshire. More than 120 places have been removed. Four British soldiers killed in the Korean War of the 1950s have been identified after a six-year investigation. Our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie joined some of their children at a ceremony in Busan to rename their graves.
Within the rows of graves here, there are four new headstones, once marked unknown soldier. They now carry the names of four British men, all killed in action during some of the bloodiest battles of the Korean War, which made it difficult to identify them at the time. Their families were told their bodies would never be found. But now researchers at the Ministry of Defence have worked out who they are by scouring burial reports, letters and eyewitness accounts. For Michael, whose father, Sergeant Donald Northey, left to fight when he was just a baby, the discovery has been overwhelming.
I just wailed like a banshee for about 20 minutes because it sort of haunted me. I mean, this is the closest I've been to him in 70 years.
There are still around 300 British soldiers who are unknown, and the researchers are hoping to identify more of them in the future.
Jean McKenzie reporting.
Jane, thank you. It's 10 minutes past eight. Successive governments and justice secretaries have promised to get tough on crime. That usually means more prison sentences, longer in some instances, but at the same time, there is a crisis of overcrowding in our prisons. A reality that came into sharp view when the new Labour government came into power this summer, and it moved to let out thousands of prisoners early, around 2,800 across 2 months, to try to relieve some of that pressure. Ministers blamed the disgraceful dereliction of duty by the Conservative government to fail to tackle the problem. That did not prevent loud criticism and the sight of some criminals leaving prison, doing a thumbs-up sign and thanking Sir Keir Starmer. The UK currently incarcerates more people per head than any other Western European country, and demand for prison places is currently growing at 4,500 places per year. Last month, the government asked David Gawk, a former Conservative Justice Secretary, to lead a sentencing review to tackle prison overcrowding, and today he kicks off that process, expected to conclude next spring, I should say, but today inviting people to submit their ideas for reform over the next 8 weeks, alongside others conducting the review. And he joins us now. David Gawk, good morning.
Good morning.
What are you asking for and from whom?
Well, we're asking anyone who wants to make a contribution to this debate for ideas, proposals, suggestions, evidence that can help us, guide us in coming forward with recommendations that addresses the challenge that you have very clearly set out, that our prisons are full, they are projected to increase, demand is projected to increase very significantly over the years ahead, and there isn't capacity. We need to step back and look at what is happening with sentencing policy. And I think there are opportunities to look at how technology, for example, can play a part in helping to monitor people outside of prison, for example, or to find ways in which we can punish people, but not necessarily in a prison cell. I think it's also an opportunity to look at what is happening in other countries, yes, some of the approaches that have been taken there, where, as you say, prison populations tend to be much lower than they are in the UK.
I mean, there are certain cultural issues or norms and issues around the economies in those countries where it may not be something we can compare. But let's get to those in just a moment. On a very basic level, I always like to know, how can you get in touch?
So it's possible if we've published our contact details in terms of the call for evidence. If you go to the Ministry of Justice website, there's information there. We're very happy to take written submissions. As you say, it runs for 8 weeks, but obviously the sooner people can provide the evidence, the sooner we can look at it.
So encourage people
to do that.
Any of our Radio 4 listeners can go to do that should they feel they have something to contribute. But how serious is this crisis? The word crisis is used. Would you say it is one? And for those who want to know, how did we get here or why are we here? You are a former Conservative Justice Secretary. The people you're now working with, the new government, Labour, blamed successive Conservative governments for this problem. You know, not necessarily trying to get into whether it was the Conservatives or successive governments per se, but what is your read on that, of why we are here and how much is it a crisis?
Well, first of all, I think it is fair to describe it as a crisis. We are projected to run out of places again, and notwithstanding the action that the government took, which I don't think any government would want to take, but the action that the government took earlier this year in terms of releasing prisoners earlier in their sentence than was otherwise going to be the case. Why has this happened? I think it would be fair to say that for something like 30 years now, successive governments of all colours have been inclined to put up sentences to encourage judges to put people inside for longer than was previously the case. Now, you can argue, well, you build your way out of it, you just keep building those prisons. That evidently has not happened. But I think there is a question to be asked. Do we want to keep on building prison capacity when, one, it is very expensive, and two, the evidence does not suggest that that is an effective way of reducing crime. Now, of course, prisons are going to be a really important part of our criminal justice system, whatever happens. Yes. Any government is going to be focused on public protection and making sure that the public are protected from offenders. But the UK relies much more heavily on prison than any other Western European country.
Why weren't more prisons built, though, during 14 years of Conservative rule, if you could see these numbers?
Well, I think it's a complex issue. There are many factors here. There are, of course, always going to be choices in terms of where you spend money. I think you could look at some of the decisions that were taken, particularly after 2019, I would say, in terms of lengthening the amount of time people were spending in prison, the proportion of their sentence that was served in prison cells. That's had a substantial impact and is playing through now, but there wasn't the increase in prison capacity. I think clearly no one would say we are in a good position at the moment, and a series of mistakes have been made.
It's just trying to diagnose that. We should just remind our listeners, you had the Conservative whip removed by Boris Johnson with the way that you voted on Brexit and then stood as an independent. So your end with the Conservative Party when you were an MP wasn't with the Conservative Party, just in case people don't remember that. And that change that you're talking about in that period was at the same time. But I suppose it's just when you were Justice Secretary, was there just a sort of blind eye turned to this reality? Because you weren't building more prisons, but you could see the numbers then.
Well, in my time as Justice Secretary, what I was trying to do was stabilise the prison population. So I was very aware of the dangers that we faced if we kept on going down the route of imprisoning more and more people. And I did announce the building of a new prison, and indeed plans were put in place for a second prison in my time.
But you were trying to control that population.
I was
maybe
trying to control
the takes
demand,
us back
yes.
to where we are now. It's not just trying to look back, we're trying to look forward. And I suppose the other thing just to say is the political reality of this. It is something politicians like to say when campaigning, we will be tough on crime. It is seen by some as a vote winner. It's popular with the public. What's not popular is the sight of prisoners coming out of jail, doing thumbs up to the Prime Minister, saying cheers, Keir, in front of a Bentley, as we saw one 29-year-old who was released 7 weeks early for a very violent crime. We also, seeing that across the board, we've also seen in the iPaper yesterday that one of the women's charities, Women's Aid, has said they now know of some individuals, domestic abusers, who have perpetrated more abuse within days of being released. Just as you form this sentencing review, was it a mistake to release nearly 3,000 prisoners, do you think?
Well, of course, that was a decision for the government.
What's your view of it?
Let me say, all I can say is, in the circumstances that they inherited, and I do not speak as a Labour person, but in these circumstances that they inherited, they had to free up capacity in the prison system. And they had no choice but to do that. And I think any government of any colour would have been forced to make that decision or something very like that decision at that particular time. And what we want to avoid is a situation where prisoners are being released as a short-term reduce the pressure moment. What we have to be is more strategic. We have to make sure that prison capacity meets demand. And that means we have to look at the question of demand on prison places. And that's where I think looking at the sentencing regime is necessary and important.
How radical could you be, David Gawke? How, for instance, just to run through some of the ideas that people are aware of, could you do away with women going to prison altogether? Most prison sentences by the female population, which is much smaller that state than the male, are short. And they are, as people have described in campaign in this area, very disruptive to women's lives. Would you be as radical to say that?
Well, what I'd say in terms of women prisoners, clearly there are some women prisoners who must go to prison, who commit serious offences, and it's right that prison is where they go. But I think there is a case for looking at, if you like, short sentences more generally. I think there are particular issues with women offenders who are very often themselves victims of crime, very often face issues to do with mental health, substance abuse and so on, that could be better addressed outside prison. So I'd certainly want to look at that. And I do think that this is a point I made when I was Justice Secretary, that we could reduce the female prison population.
And shorter sentences generally. But the idea, do you think our probation service is good enough to and invested in enough to be able to have community options?
I think you make a really important point here, because if we are going to look at alternatives to prison, we need to make sure that those are workable alternatives, that they are practical, that they can be done. It may well be there be a need for greater resources in the probation system. It may be that resources within the probation system need to be redeployed. But I think it's a very fair challenge to say, OK, if you're not going to rely on custodial sentences in these cases, you're going to have non-custodial sentences. Are they going to be workable? That's one of the things that the panel will be wanting to look at.
And Do you think Keir Starmer's got the political stomach for this? I look at a headline in the Daily Telegraph today that you've given in a short interview there, which has gone straight for jail terms for serious crimes could be cut to ease space, especially with his background as the former director of public prosecutions. Do you think he could actually go through with that sort of reality?
Well, I think let's see what we recommend. We're just beginning the process here.
But there's a direction of travel that you've outlined that does require a strong political stomach. Do you think he's got it?
Well, look, I'm delighted to have been asked to lead this review.
Right.
I don't think I would have been asked to lead this review if the government wasn't prepared to face up to some of the fundamental challenges that are here. So, you know, my plan is to come forward working with the panel with recommendations that do reassure the public about protection and that prison is an important part of punishing offenders, but also puts our prison system and our criminal justice system on a more sustainable basis that is more effective in terms of rehabilitating offenders that can therefore bring down crime.
Yeah.
And ensure that, you know, we are not going to run out of prison places again in the way that we have done over this summer. And you know, I very much hope that we can come forward with recommendations that the Prime Minister is able to support.
We shall see. David Gawk, I'm sure we'll talk again. Thank you for your time this morning.
It's 22 minutes past eight. Nearly any parent will tell you getting children to read books when they are surrounded by screens is a challenge, to say the least. For some young children, the COVID-19 pandemic only made that harder, being away from the encouragement that teachers might give. The Lit Up initiative in East Sussex was set up to tackle literacy challenges amongst children. It involved encouraging parent and children reading sessions. And of course, it takes two to tango, and the way that parents themselves read is changed by their involvement in reading to their children. Charlotte Wellham in Penrith in Cumbria has been reading to her son Ennis, who is five. I spoke to both of them earlier this morning. I started by asking Charlotte about the challenges she had faced with reading.
I think I've got into the habit of, like with a lot of people nowadays with technology, obviously everything's so visual, but generally we are quite stuck on our phones and things like that. And I did go, especially being a mum of two young children, I went through a real slump of reading of just not having the energy to do it, to be honest. But I have really, especially since Ennis has started school, I have really got more into the habit of reading again, especially with visiting our local library when I'm borrowing books for them. I am now borrowing books for myself. So it's been really nice to take up the habit again, for sure.
So when there was a sort of feedback loop, when you were both borrowing books and of course, reading books for your kids, you started to think, oh, this is nice. I remember this and pick it up again yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, I was very lucky in the fact that I've never struggled with reading. You know, as a child, I did very well with reading. And growing up in the age of Harry Potter, which really kind of made the reading boom again, yeah. I really did enjoy it. And it was a shame to kind of forget the habit of doing it.
And you find the time, do you, in between two children? And
I got into a really bad habit of looking at, and I'm sure lots of people do, looking at my phone literally up till going to bed.
Yeah.
I am now taking the time to sit down and have a good, you know, half an hour to an hour before bed just to read. No. So,
Ennis, I can hear you interrupting. Ennis, Ennis, let's talk first. You like mum reading with you?
Yeah.
And what's special about having mum read with you? Why is it so nice? Is it her voice or is it the story?
We do it before you go to bed, don't we? So we have a moment where he reads his book he's brought home from school, and then we like to read a book you've chosen that Mummy reads to you before bed, don't you?
Yeah,
and you enjoy it.
And Ennis, what's your favourite kind of book? What's it about?
The Tiger Who Came to Tea.
Oh, that's such a good one, isn't it?
A classic.
Yeah, but I'm not having those little thin ones.
You like the bigger books, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a bigger Tiger Who Came to Tea.
Yeah.
And you pull the things on, things happen. And then after the Tiger Who drank the tea, I flat the other page, yeah. And it made the whole kitchen.
A whole kitchen?
Yeah.
Sounds fantastic. Can I ask you a secret question? Is Mummy or Daddy the best reader?
I think Mummy.
I think you've done very well there. Charlotte, I want to just talk about how that overlap happened between reading with Ennis and you sort of rediscovering the joy of either reading or hearing books, because I think you're an audiobook fan as well, aren't you? Can you go into that? I guess some people who are big readers will be thinking, oh, I never lost the love of reading. But
I think it was important. It is very important because I think, you know, everyday life just gets so in the way. And, you know, at the moment, the world isn't a very nice place at the moment. So it is actually very nice to have a bit of an escape. And also, I got in a habit of always rereading the same books. But as I've grown up and kind of matured and developed more of an interest in different subjects, I'm really going through a habit at the moment of reading the classics, you know, like Little Women, Wuthering Heights and things like that, which I absolutely despised at school doing GCSEs, you know, literature and things like that. So just it being pushed again and being more integrated into our everyday life, having children, because I think it's a different attitude to reading than, say, like homework. You know, I think we start subconsciously doing it with our babies. You know, we read them bedtime stories and then as they grow and things like that. So I think that's when it started, was actually when the children were born. And, you know, you're given books to them for Christmas and things like that. So without me realising, I think I began becoming more interested in reading again.
And I have to ask you this one about Ennis. I mean, do you dread the moment when screens, phones and tablets sort of pop into view for him? Are you worried that will be the end of reading?
Ennis is only 5 and his younger brother is only 3. And I mean, by the time they're kind of teenagers, the attitude might have changed completely by then. But yeah, I've got kind of a bit of a mixed feeling about how it's integrated into schools. I think they are a fantastic tool, but at the same time, you've just got to be kind of aware of the amount of use they have every day. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting journey, I think, with them as they grow up. But as of yet, he hasn't really shown a huge drive of interest with them.
We'll wait and see. Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us. Ennis, thank you so much. Have a lovely day, Ennis.
Bye.
Excellent work there, all round, Johnny. Greatly enjoyed that.
Well, Ennis was so sweet.
Yeah, I mean, Ennis should be here every day. Right, just to say, we were talking to the former Justice Secretary, David Gawk, who has kick-started that sentencing review today. And he said, for you, for the public to be involved with ideas for how to reduce the prison population, innovation, calling for all of that. And he did say right at the beginning of that interview that the information of how to get in touch with the group responsible for doing that for the government was on the Ministry of Justice website. We do like to check things for you. A number of you got in touch to say you couldn't find the details. I'm not sure we can either yet, but perhaps we're not as fluent as we should be with the Ministry of Justice website, and perhaps that's going to be updated as we speak. If you cannot get in touch with the Ministry of Justice, we can be a substitute here at the Today programme. So do get in touch with your ideas for reform for prison sentencing. We're interested to hear them. The number on WhatsApp, 0330 123 4346, or email today@bbc.co.uk. But we wanted to come back to you with that. But let's get to the sport, shall we? Because Carthy's just walked back in. Hello, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The England men's football captain, Harry Kane, has expressed his disappointment that 9 players have withdrawn from the latest international squad. Kane's criticism comes ahead of tonight's Nations League game against Greece. The Republic of Ireland host Finland later before facing England on Sunday. And last night, Chelsea women beat Celtic 2-1 in the Champions League to remain top of their group. Now, England's men's cricketers are 2-0 ahead in their T20 series with West Indies, with the third match taking place in St Lucia today. The West Indies team was considered one of the best in the world 40 years ago, but cricket in the region has changed on and off the pitch. I've been speaking to the outgoing chief executive of Cricket West Indies, Johnny Grave, about how the finances of the sport's big three, that's England, India and Australia, affects the smaller nations, and about the business behind that special brand after hosting this summer's Men's T20 World Cup.
Yeah, look, it's given us a massive boost, both to Cricket West Indies, to our sort of stadium infrastructure in particular, as well as a huge economic boost to the whole region, really, with so many travelling fans and the eyes of the world very much centred on the West Indies. In sort of monetary terms, I guess we'll have a record year as Cricket West Indies, with record revenues of approaching sort of $90 million US, and therefore a big boost to our surpluses that we need to carry forward in the next couple of years. I mean, we think over $100 million US invested into the stadium, the six stadiums that hosted, as well as creating, I guess, a sort of a new standard across venues in the West Indies. But that means that we won't need to go into borrowing. We won't need to get into financial difficulties. We've got a solid base now in which to build on, very much leading into what we hope will be an India tour in 2027.
You've been quite vocal on the need for a fund for test playing nations outside of that big three. How would that work, and what are the financial issues facing a body like Cricket West Indies?
Well, I think we're in a similar boat as the other sort of major test playing nations that aren't the big three, and that is very much that we are reliant really on our ICC revenues as well as those big high generating revenue tours of England and India in order to sustain our cricket systems. And obviously what happens at ICC is that the revenues that are distributed to the members are skewed towards those members that contribute the most in terms of the big economic markets. And obviously the bilateral cricket model, which is where the home team keeps all of the revenue that they generate within their country, and the opposition board has to fund their team getting there and all their player costs. We've made further calls around the need to have a test match fund to help make test match cricket more popular, to invest in it in order to play more three match series rather than these two match series that seem to have become the norm for teams outside of the big three. There have been very positive noises recently coming out of the leadership of England, Australia and India around the need to get competitive balance in order to make the game more compelling from a viewer perspective. If there's more jeopardy, more teams can win, we should create a better product. But it's an ongoing discussion, and certainly not one that I've been able to solve in my 7.5 years at West Indies cricket.
You mentioned the revenue on the men's side. Was making sure that there was pay parity for women's cricket when it comes to match fees, prize money and bonuses by 2027, was that part of something you wanted to leave as a legacy?
Well, certainly we'd identified the need to address the sort of the gender parity, not just in terms of pay, but also in terms of opportunity. We've announced in the last few weeks that our West Indies women's team are going to return to playing test match cricket after a long, long break. And we feel it's only right, especially when we've got iconic global stars like Hayley Matthews, that she gets the opportunity to lead a team out wearing that iconic maroon test cap. And certainly the pay parity is all part of that move.
You are now out of the role, which you started in 2017. When you began, was it daunting to take on a role that covers a variety of territories with different national identities?
Yeah, it was. Look, I'd worked in 17 years of English cricket and certainly was looking for my next opportunity and change, having worked a decade at the Players Association. And yeah, West Indies was such an iconic brand, as you say, and played such an exciting form of cricket that sort of dominated my childhood and played in a completely different way to watching England grow up. And yeah, when the opportunity was not just to take on the challenge, but also to move out to Antigua, where the Cricket West Indies headquarters are based, yeah, it was certainly an exciting prospect, but it was also one that yeah, it was probably a bit daunting, but I was certainly up for the challenge. I never thought it would last 7.5 years, but it's been fantastic. And COVID aside, obviously that was a very difficult 2 years, but outside of that, it's been an amazing experience for me and for my family.
Thank you very much, Johnny Grave.
Thanks, Arthur.
Just a couple of tennis lines for you. The two-time Wimbledon champion Carlos Alcaraz beat the world number 8, Andrei Rublev, at the end of season ATP finals in Turin. Despite suffering from a chest condition, the world number 2, Alexander Zverev, claimed his second victory of the week, defeating Norway's Casper Ruud. And the opening day of matches at the Billie Jean King Cup had to be postponed due to a red weather alert in Malaga. The tournament should start today, with Great Britain facing Germany tomorrow.
Cathy, thank you very much. I forgot to thank you in the last hour. I'm sorry about that. It's
quite
always right. Lovely to have
quite
you.
Right. Unforgivable.
Did say sorry. In Our Time is coming up at 9. Here's Melvin Bragg.
Good morning. We'll be talking about the Antikythera mechanism from about 100 years BC, one of the most exciting objects to survive from the ancient world. Its discovery has been compared to finding an internal combustion engine in Tutankhamun's tomb. When salvaged from a wreck in 1901, it was overlooked as a rusty lump of metal, but it turned out to be a kind of computer for predicting the movement of the planets, made with ingenuity unmatched until the great cathedral clocks of medieval Europe over 1,000 years later. That's the Antikythera mechanism with Joe Marchant, Lieber Taub and Mike Edmonds on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to today.
Thanks very much for that. Look at the weather. Today we'll see any early low cloud, fog and mist soon lift to leave a dry day with a mix of variable clouds and sunny spells for most. And I love this. A gentle wind will be associated.
We love a gentle wind. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Johnny Diamond. It's 25 minutes to nine. Let's get a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will set out plans for pension reform later, involving the merger of dozens of local government pension schemes into eight so-called mega funds. In a first Mansion House speech, she'll argue the bigger funds will deliver more growth. A row has broken out in government about changes to inheritance tax for farms. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs has been pressing for a softening of the new rules announced in the budget, but its appeal has been rejected by the Treasury. Independent pharmacies in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have voted in favour of industrial action. Members of the National Pharmacy Association want an increase in funding and are threatening to reduce opening hours in the new year if their demand is not met. A panel of experts has been appointed to carry out a review of prison sentencing in England and Wales in a bid to reduce overcrowding and reoffending. People are also being invited to submit their ideas for reform over the next 8 weeks. The review is led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawke, who told this programme prisons are in crisis and that a workable solution is needed to reassure the public.
Thank you, Jane. Pension mega funds are what we expect the Chancellor to announce when she addresses city grandees this evening at the Mansion House in London, bringing together dozens of public sector pension funds and hoping that their amalgamated firepower will bring higher returns and help boost investment. One man enmeshed in the world of pensions is Sir Steve Webb, a partner at Pensions Consultants LCP, a former Liberal Democrat work and pensions minister. Good morning, Sir Steve.
Good morning.
Rachel Reeves has said our pension funds in Britain are too small to be making the investments that get a good return for people saving for retirement and to help our economy grow. The solution, she suggests, is bringing a lot of these smaller funds together into these mega funds. Will that change things?
It will, and it's certainly true by international standards. British pension system is pretty fragmented and there are small inefficient pension schemes out there. I think in terms of bringing local government pension schemes together, it's fair to say that George Osborne first announced this in 2015. So these mega funds already exist in the local government scheme, but they haven't progressed as rapidly as everyone wanted, partly because with over 80 local schemes and local councillors and others wanting their say, it's been quite sticky to make that progress. So this will be evolution in the local government system. Merging private sector pension schemes will be a much more radical change.
Why?
Well, because at the moment what's happened is that automatic enrolment, when you have a job, the company has to put you in a pension, has created lots and lots of what are called master trust, big pension arrangements, but also some medium-sized and small-sized ones as well. And at the moment, there's nothing to stop you running a small pension arrangement. And what Rachel Reeves seems to be suggesting is that some quite chunky limits would be set. So if you're running a small pension scheme, no matter how good it is, you'll be forced to combine with others, and that will be a very big shake-up.
Why is it that a really big fund will bring in higher returns? I mean, I can presume you might have somewhat smaller costs if you've got a big fund, but why is it that the idea that they'll have this sort of firepower to bring in higher returns and at the same time help domestic investment?
Well, you've put your finger on the key that the government is interested in one thing only, and that's what they call productive investment. So they want money for green hydrogen and for wind farms and for the energy infrastructure and all of that kind of thing. And they're laser focused on that. And there is evidence that as you get bigger, as you get to 25 billion, even 50 billion, you've got the expertise, you've got the time and skills, you can allocate money to these kind of things in a way that a small scheme may not be able to. But the worry is that actually there are some very high quality, smaller pension schemes, perhaps run by very good employers who want to give a really good pension to their workers, which wouldn't meet a size test. And I think the government has to remember that big isn't always beautiful, that what matters isn't only size, but quality, investment returns, quality of service. And really, high quality small schemes shouldn't be driven out.
And briefly, you mentioned that local government has started this merging process. Have we seen any results yet as to their returns and the direction of their investment?
It's probably early days, partly because it's taken an awful lot of legislation even to get as far as we've got. I mean, you know, the merging that's gone on is generally gone well. It won't increase local government workers' pensions because they're guaranteed anyway. But some of it will increase local investment. Obviously, that's something the government's keen to see.
So, Stephen Webb, thank you very much indeed.
20 to 9. What does Donald Trump's return to the White House mean for global relations as he makes his political appointments, some of which we've been covering on this programme this morning and in previous days? Keen geopolitical watchers are trying to predict what will come to pass and which of his messages from the campaign trail will become domestic and foreign policy. One key international relationship is, of course, China. Peter Frankopan, Professor of Global History at Oxford, Director of the Oxford Centre for Byzantine Research and the author of several books, including The Silk Roads and The Earth Transformed, is on the line. Good morning.
Morning, Emma.
What do you take from some of the political appointees of Trump to mean about that approach to China? Some have said it signals another hawkish approach.
Well, all of the picks that Trump has announced so far are very specific China hawks. But having said that, bipartisan views on China have embedded themselves in the US over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. So that's not an enormous surprise. I think most of us expect Trump to follow through what he's been promising on the campaign trail, which is tariffs on China of about 60% across the board. But he's also been saying that he's going to put 10 to 20% across tariffs even on America's allies. So in practice, that means that there's going to be some space, I think, for China to try to exploit the fact that it's a stable state and that China works with multilateral countries and relationships to try to boost trade and to keep tariffs down. And we've got next week the APEC meeting in Peru, followed by G20 in Brazil. And I think that there will be voices that China's going to be thinking about how does it try to position itself as being a champion of free trade where the US puts up barriers. And that's a sort of hall of mirrors, really, the idea that a Marxist-Leninist state is the one that's trying to galvanise and push trade, whereas the US is the one making things harder for people.
The 60% tariffs, if that's where he goes, what is that a difference to of policy with Joe Biden? How does it differ?
Well, sometimes we think about things, you know, because we play the man, not the ball. You know, Biden kept all of Trump's tariffs and, in fact, tightened them up in some cases. So I think that that's no great surprise. I mean, what's interesting is that China doesn't have an enormous amount of leverage to push back onto the United States if the US does impose some tariffs. The one place it can hurt, ironically, are businesses controlled by Elon Musk, particularly gigafactories in China and Tesla. So there's been a lot of chat in China in the last 6 months about whether Elon Musk will play the role of a sort of Henry Kissinger brokering both business deals and geopolitical stability. Is this going to be a new era of Nixon and Mao in the early 70s? And the fact that Musk has been so close to Trump and has in fact been appointed to an advisory board, as you mentioned yesterday on the programme, Emma, means that there's a lot of attention, I think, to what this means for not just gigafactories, Musk in particular, but also about low Earth orbit satellites. Musk has a very important space programme, and space is an area where China's competing very aggressively with the United States too.
But just on that particular point, the concern about conflicts of interest when it comes to Musk, is that a concern when you highlight that particular potential diplomatic, political role with his own interests?
Well, I think it's fair to say the social media space in China is split between those who think that Trump will be pragmatic and will do business and reach agreements, not just on trade, but perhaps even on things like Taiwan. And after all, when Trump had hawks in place in his first presidency, he did eventually come to the table to deal on Huawei and ZTE, two big telecom companies, around some of the things that were national security worries, and he did soften on those. So some think that he'll be pragmatic and put business first. The more sort of crude ones say that Trump would be willing to sell a member of his own family, therefore Taiwan doesn't have a chance. But then there are those who are more cautious, who think that Trump's tariffs might crash the markets by putting pressure particularly on the Chinese currency that might lead to major devaluation. And last time Trump came in, the pressure on Chinese currency, on the yuan or renminbi, led to a huge capital flight, at least $1 trillion moving out of China. So that's going to put a challenge for the Chinese to also work out how to manage their own economy, which is already in a pretty overheated state.
But just to end on that, I mean, the desperation of China post-COVID is what sort of level in terms of the economic picture there?
I don't think central bankers anywhere in the world tend to be desperate. I mean, no more than they are here in London. They have to play the cards that they've been dealt. I mean, I think in the short term, what this will mean will be that prices in the US will go up if Trump puts tariffs on. That means American goods will become more competitive for American consumers. China, deprived of an important market. I mean, it exports a lot to ASEAN and Southeast Asian countries and all across Asia, means that China will presumably incentivize low prices and incentivized trade, and that will mean that there'll be some opportunities for us in other parts of the world to have different kinds of pressures of cheaper goods, because yes. China will be subsidizing because it needs to get rid of excess capacity, as well as building that narrative. So I think we're in for a bumpy ride for the global macroeconomy in the coming years, because it takes a bit of time for inflation to push through.
But
I think that's as Xinhua calls it, it's the question of the century.
Bumpy ride. We'll talk again. Peter Frankopan, thank you.
Now, coming up on Radio 4, Melvin Bragg and his guests unearth a 2,000-year-old device which transformed our understanding of astronomy in ancient Greece. That's in this morning's edition of In Our Time, coming up at 9 o'clock. Or, if you'd rather something, yes, completely different, our colleagues at Radio 3 have launched a new music stream called Radio 3 Unwind. I think it's fair to say it's a very mellow music stream. Just go to BBC Sounds, tap on Radio 3 Unwind, or you can call your smart speaker and say, play Radio 3 Unwind. It is as simple as that. On yesterday's programme, we heard about concerns being raised over the use of physician associates in hospitals and surgeries. Physician associates are medical professionals with 2 years' training who are supposed to support the work of doctors. The concern raised by a group of consultants is that lives are being put at risk through their increased use in healthcare. So Stephen Powers is National Medical Director for NHS England. I asked him about his concerns about physician associates being deployed.
Well, physician associates have been part of clinical teams within the NHS for over 20 years. Their role is to perform specific tasks that they've been specifically trained for, to assist doctors and other clinicians. And of course, that must always be done under supervision. So the role is quite clear, and we have issued guidance to hospital trusts to ensure that they are following that guidance. But there have been some legitimate concerns raised, and it's really important that we take those seriously. So I think, as the Secretary of State has said recently, we are considering the best way to address those.
Do you think the guidance you've issued either needs to be refreshed or emphasised for hospitals and surgeries? And BBC News has learned that physician associates have exceeded their remit in a number of different trusts, covering doctors' shifts, prescribing medicines, ordering up x-rays. It's not their job. And clearly they are sliding in some places into places they're not meant to be.
So we have heard concerns that they have been potentially acting outside of their remit in certain situations. When we hear that, we always contact the hospital trust concerned to ensure that they are working within the remit. We are due to expand physician associates and anaesthetic associates over the next decade or so as part of the long-term workforce plan. I think it is important at this stage that we take a time to do a little bit of a stock take and ensure that we do have clarity over the role. Because, of course, patient safety is always going to be at the heart of everything that we do, the same for every professional member of the healthcare team. And it's important that we get this right at the start.
All through the morning on the programme today, we've been discussing prostate cancer, the threat of it, and the screening programme. We heard from a guest earlier who said, you know, look, when you're a woman, you get a letter and you automatically go on to a breast cancer screening. Why is it different for men, given the prevalence of prostate cancer and the damage it causes?
So, of course, national screening programmes are determined by the National Screening Committee, who look very carefully at the evidence, the pros and cons of population-level screening programmes, and provide advice to ministers and ultimately the Secretary of State, who decides whether they should be implemented. It's our job in NHS England to implement those programmes. We implement the breast screening programme that you've mentioned. And I understand the concern and understand the calls for a screening programme, but it is important that it's done on a strong evidence base, because there are potential benefits, but there are also potential harms. And that is what the National Screening Committee weighs up. It has looked at the evidence before. It will continue to look at the evidence. And, of course, there are new trials that are being undertaken, one particularly in this country that's about to start, that will provide further evidence. And when it is convinced, when it is sure that the evidence base is in favour of that population-based screening approach, as it was with breast screening, then I'm sure it will recommend a screening programme, and then, of course, our job to implement it.
What is the trade-off for a screening programme for prostate cancer? Is it that, look, it'll be very expensive and resources are strained and the justification isn't there yet? Or is it because of what we also heard from about concerns about over-treatment?
It's the latter rather than the former.
Right.
It is those clinical concerns around over-treatment, around over-diagnosis, about some prostate cancers are not requiring intervention because they are relatively mild in the scale of things. Prostate cancer is quite a complicated cancer and there are lots of treatments available, and the treatments, as you heard, are evolving all the time. That's really good news. But it is getting that balance of benefit and harm right, particularly at population level, where you are deploying a whole programme across a whole population.
Can you see that it's quite difficult for men who are, as we know, a bit more reticent to go to the doctor? But when there isn't a sort of a national impetus, it's sort of left up to them and perhaps individual GPs to book themselves in for a test, rather than that kind of automatic go and get tested. It's a difficult message for some men.
And I can see why it's quite puzzling for people when they think about it. But one of the things that we do really well in the UK is the national screening programmes. And one of the reasons we do that well is that we are very clear that there needs to be the evidence base there before we deploy them. And then when we deploy them at scale and we deploy them well. And they produce huge benefit. The National Screening Committee meets regularly. It does look at evidence across a whole range of potential screening programmes. You know, like all health professionals, the people who sit in it are really keen to make a difference, but they're also really keen to ensure that that is done on the basis of the best possible trial evidence, clinical trial evidence, and other clinical evidence that underpins these programmes.
May I ask you about pharmacies? Mm-hmm. We have a threat of reduced hours, possible industrial action in the new year. A lot of pharmacists say they are feeling extraordinary financial pressures. Do you understand those pressures? And is there any response to them? Is there any answer to them?
Yes, we are aware of the pressures that high street community pharmacists and pharmacies are under at the moment. We are hugely supportive of them. They do a huge amount of valuable work for the NHS. And we understand their concerns. Of course, they have particular concern following the budget. That, of course, is a matter for government. It's a matter for the Department of Health and Social Care in particular, and they are thinking about a response. Our job, again, at NHS England is to support colleagues in government in thinking about that. But I think the key message for the public is do continue to use pharmacies. We, of course, will work with the pharmacy community that if they do take any action, we will do what we can to mitigate that.
Dr. Stephen Powers, thank you.
It's 7 minutes to nine.
Now, the days continue to get shorter, and whilst there is great joy to be found in the British autumn and winter, we have the best seasons in the world, of course, for some the darkness is a particular issue. Contemporary artist Emily Powell understands that and is hoping to confront it. She's about to fling open the doors of the 18th century barn that serves as her studio in Dartmoor, and perhaps push back the darkness with a new series of artworks inspired by her travels to the Norwegian Arctic. And when people see her paintings, they will be confronted by a blaze of colour and light. Emily Powell joins us. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's lovely to have you on. Tell me, if you would, about colour and its import, especially in the winter.
It's so important to me at this time of year. I really struggle with feeling quite low at this time of year after losing my dad really early on. In my life, I've always struggled with winter, and I've always used colour at this time of year to really cheer myself up. So I use pinks and reds and oranges to really lift my mood. I can't bear any sort of cold blues, cold greys. You know, I'm always on the hunt for that warmth and that energy from colour.
I want to talk in a little bit, if I may do, about the loss of your father and what that means and the season in particular. But first of all, about this expedition that you went on to the Norwegian Arctic. You must have had to prepare fairly firmly for another world.
Yes, we did. We got a team together. Yeah. My sister's a GP and my studio assistant is very can-do when it comes to travel. We took our video maker, filmer, and got all the paints and found lots of unexpected things to overcome there. Like the paint didn't dry because it was minus temperatures. So there was lots of obstacles to overcome.
were all the paintings that are displayed, were they all painted sort of on the spot in the Arctic, or were some done from memory when you returned?
So there's a group that were painted in the Arctic, and they have all the sort of coral from the beach on them and all the sort of markings from where I've sort of taken them up mountains and things. And then when I came back, I couldn't bear to paint small. So I got my sort of brushes and brooms and big buckets of paint out, and I painted my whole barn on Dartmoor in giant paintings of the mountains and the landscape that I saw there.
When you look between the paintings that were that were done on the spot and those that you did later, is there a big difference?
There is a little bit of a difference, I suppose. When I came back, I was able to really go big with the mark making. And when I paint smaller, things are a bit tighter. So when I could really let loose, it felt really cathartic. So there's just paint spillage everywhere on the big pieces, and it's just that happy colour chaos.
You've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, as you mentioned, following the death of your father in childhood. He died in October as the days get shorter.
Yeah.
Confronting the darkness of these seasons is important for you personally.
Very much. I think, you know, grief is so horrendous and it makes you feel so small and everything becomes so grey. And actually confronting it with life and going to find these big landscapes and going to paint with these big colours and getting the brooms out and doing big acts of bravery, like huge paintings, just helps me no end at this time of year.
Some people will have sort of light therapy. Others are invited into your studio, and you think that that may well give them the lift over these dark days.
That's it. I mean, I always look at this time of year for things that will sort of cheer me up and be a bit of a beacon of a place to find warmth and things and like-minded people. So I really wanted it to be that for others as well as me.
Emily, thank you so much. I should say, I've got some of Emily's pictures in front of me, and they are absolutely astonishing blaze of colour, these landscapes that she has painted.
Yeah, they are beautiful. We have to try and paint those pictures for you on the radio. We do our best. And thank you to you for getting in touch this morning in response to our interview earlier. I spoke to David Gawk, the former Justice Secretary, who's been tasked by this government with coming up with ideas of how to deal with the overcrowding crisis in our prisons. The Ministry of Justice has opened that call for evidence today. We tried to find how to contact them, and apparently it will be open, or that individual body, it will be open from 10 a.m. So in the meantime, you've been getting in touch with us here at the programme. We're very grateful. One listener simply writes in, no name, to say, we must look at demand, quoting David Gawk, for prison places. Why? Look at supply. On that point, Suzanne's message to say the work of community and youth workers, a vastly underfunded service now, is invaluable in intervening before the harm is done. Working with young people in our communities, funding youth clubs, sports clubs and a myriad of others, not only focuses young people in areas of activity they can enjoy and learn from, but enables the people working on the ground to facilitate help and support at an early age. Thank you for that, Suzanne. And Greg, a criminal barrister listening in Bristol this morning, says the most significant problem lies with drug offences. If we are not going to decriminalise drug use and make controlled drugs available on prescription at dedicated walk-in centres, which Greg says we should, then the sentencing regime should be changed. Currently, the standard sentence for low-level street dealing starts at 4.5 years, and most of these people are drug users themselves, living desperately poor and self-destructive lifestyles. They need intensive state intervention, housing, healthcare, job training, not years in prison, from which they inevitably re-offend
upon release. Well, David Gawke said he wanted to hear from you. You have not disappointed. The Ministry of Justice apparently opening those submissions, those ability to put your ideas forward. And he said, make